Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
You're not really a slave, you know. You're a co-worker. You know, you're a member of the firm, you know. This is the Bodie Plantation, you know. And you are one of our business associates. Now, get that plow moving.
Behind me, we have two people working on the log cabin. They're breaking the log apart with an axe.
Michelle Taylor is at a cabin building workshop in Mount Pelier, the former estate of President James Madison in Virginia. It's part of a program to help reconstruct the grounds of the estate, including its slave dwellings.
It's the size of an apartment living room with the capacity to hold 3-4 families at a time.
Michelle Taylor grew up in Detroit. She's 26 years old and has studied anthropology at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. She's now a research associate at VCU's Virtual Curation Laboratory, and through research, she learned about her personal connection to Madison's estate.
George Gilmore was a part of the enslaved community at Mount Pelier. George Gilmore is my Aunt Lucy's great-grandfather.
Independent producer Kelly Libby recently caught up with Michelle Taylor at Mount Pelier. She sent us Taylor's story about studying the past hands-on.
The quarters where the enslaved people lived, they lived in different parts of the plantation, particularly with the filled slave corridor. That would be the slaves that lived not in close proximity to President Madison, but would have also been responsible for cultivating wheat and rye on the plantation. I had took a break outside, and when I looked at the landscape at Mount Pelier, you see mountains and acres of empty land, and it made me think about my ancestors not having an opportunity to go anywhere, nowhere to run away. It was just very emotional, being able to know that I had an opportunity. I could have left at any time, but I wanted to be there to make a difference and rebuild this home that represents where my family would have lived during that time period.
Make sure your lines are good, you know.
We had like a presentation the first day, and it showed us the chainsaw and the axe. And I said, I'm never going to be able to use a chainsaw or axe. But then eventually I picked it up. I worked with the people here, practiced it over and over. And by the second day, I was using it myself with no one around. I feel as if it's an honor and a privilege because we're still at an advantage. We're working inside of a barn. We're working with higher technology tools as well as tools from the Civil War era. But it reminds me of what my ancestors could have went through to some degree. So every day I go home and I'm like, oh, my arms hurt. Oh, my legs hurt. But I'm going home to a bed. I'm going home to a roof, foundation. My day ends at 4 o'clock versus their day to go on. Having the log cabins on Mount Pelier's plantation shows not only a complete story of American history, but it also gives a sense of purpose to those descendants who hadn't been aware of their ancestors' contributions to not only President Madison's estate, but the contributions and sacrifices they made daily for us now as descendants to be able to live better lives than they did during a time period where they didn't have any choices.
That's Michelle Taylor, one of the people taking part in a log cabin expedition at Montpelier, the estate of President James Madison.
We're going to take a few minutes now to talk about sports. Now, even if you're completely consumed by March Madness, you're probably keeping an eye on the NFL draft and free agency shuffle. So we thought we'd check in on what's happening with former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. You might remember he got a lot of attention last year for choosing to kneel during the national anthem as a protest against police violence. Now he is a free agent and has not yet found a team. Now, some critics, like President Trump, think those are his just desserts.
There was an article today, it was reported, that NFL owners don't want to pick him up because they don't want to get a nasty tweet from Donald Trump. Do you believe that?
That's just one reason some prominent sports writers wonder whether Colin Kaepernick is being blacklisted for his political views. But some wonder whether maybe he's just not that good anymore. We wanted to hear more about this, so we called Bucky Brooks. He's a media analyst for the NFL Network. He played pro ball himself for 5 seasons, and he was an NFL scout, and he was nice enough to step out of a high school football clinic in Atlanta to talk with us. Bucky Brooks, thanks so much for taking our call.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Now, I understand a lot of people are tweeting you about this, so how unusual is it for somebody of Colin Kaepernick's skill to remain a free agent at this point when other people who don't have his track record have been picked up? I mean, let's remember, he took a team to the Super Bowl and an NFC championship. So how unusual is this?
I mean, it's a little unusual based on the circumstances. And, I mean, there are a lot of things at play when you look at Colin Kaepernick. I think for all of the things that he's accomplished in his league, taking a team to a Super Bowl, taking a team back to an NFC championship a year later, he has been a bit inconsistent when it comes to how his performance on the field has been. And so even though he had a poor 2015, he bounced back and had a pretty solid and respectable 2016 and flashed the ability to still be a solid player in the league at the position. What we have right now is a situation where there aren't many starting jobs available, and at his price tag, some people aren't willing to meet him halfway. And then you have the overarching impact of his protest last year, which could cause some concern about how he would be treated in the locker room and how he would be treated by a fan base.
Now, you actually did a lot of reporting on this. I mean, you talked to a lot of people from your kind of broad set of contacts. Did they say that the protest had something to do with his circumstances right now? What did they say about this?
You know, a lot of people just talked about the talent himself. A lot of people said, you know, it would take the right system for him to be able to be a solid starter in the league. But then I did have some other people allude to the fact that sometimes it may be a harder sell to bring him in when there's uncertainty about how he would be received based on the protest and other things. No one would actually go on record and say, hey, he's not signed yet because of the protest. But it certainly plays into the decision-making process when you're trying to determine between multiple players at a position, who would I rather bring in? Someone who is devoid of controversy versus someone who may have some stuff that comes with them when it comes to dealing with the backlash and the PR nightmare that could ensue when you sign up.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about that. A number of people have made the contrast between the NBA and the NFL on this whole question. I mean, is the NFL a place where an outspoken person whose views may conflict with those of the owners can find a place?
It's really a case-by-case basis. The more talented you are, the more leeway that you have in all aspects, be it taking protests, be it maybe infractions that you may have had with the law or other things. So there is some truth to that when it comes to the NFL versus the NBA. A lot of the guys that made protests or kind of spoke out in a political vein were near the end of their career, so they felt emboldened to be able to do that because they were at a point where if they didn't get another opportunity to play, they're pretty at peace with what they had accomplished in their respective league. I do believe if someone is going to take a stand, you still can take that stand, and you can do it in a manner where you don't necessarily put the team at risk or subject them to a lot of negative backlash. It just depends on your individual standing in the league and how clear and articulate you are in communicating your message and why you're protesting. And are you willing to deal with some of the ramifications that come with that?
That's Bucky Brooks. He's a sports writer and media analyst for the NFL Network, a former pro player himself and a former scout. He was kind enough to join us from Atlanta. Bucky Brooks, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
So I'm staying out of it. I'm just going to take a knee like Kaepernick and let the whites figure this out amongst themselves. Because for us, you know what I mean? We've been here before. And I don't even think it's the most important thing we're dealing with, man. Don't forget all things that are going on. Shootings. What do you think about that? All these shootings in the last year, the worst mass shootings in the history of the United States, Pulse nightclub, which they said ISIS did, and then it turned out that wasn't exactly what happened. And if that is what happened, then ISIS is scarier than I thought, because they have very deep cover operatives. Look, guys, we're going down deep for this one. I might have to get a Grindr account and jerk a few guys off and throw them off the trail.
This week, the return of a comedian who has been largely out of the spotlight for a decade.
I know I've been gone for a very long time. If Martin Luther King had a sneaker deal, we'd still be on the back of the bus. I've met O.J. Simpson on four different occasions.
That is Dave Chappelle, who last dominated the headlines when he walked away from a multi-million dollar contract with Comedy Central. That was back in 2005. He was at the top of his career when he left Chappelle's show, but we've heard little from him since. Most recently, he did host Saturday Night Live the weekend after the presidential election. Well, Dave Chappelle is back. He released two comedy specials on Netflix, and with us to review them is WNYC's culture critic, Rebecca Carroll. Rebecca, hello.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, this was a highly anticipated release. Does it live up to the hype?
Oh, for those of us who are fans, the expectations were so high. And I feel like we have to own a little bit of that, because I know that we all expected him to waltz out onto that stage and just hit it out of the park. It did not. Not only did it not meet expectations, it was pretty offensive.
He's a comedian, though. So I guess we expect some offense, and we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's talk about the moment when he left Chappelle's show, saying that Comedy Central made it no longer socially relevant. So how socially relevant is his current comedy?
Well, in some ways, it's very socially relevant. And in other ways, it's very socially offensive and very socially incorrect. It's almost as if he was asleep for 10 years and then woke up and was not sort of in touch with the current cultural parlance, you know, which is to say he spends a great bit of time talking about the LGBT community in ways that are, you know, deeply offensive. Here's a perfect example.
I know black dudes in Brooklyn, hard street that wear high heels just to feel safe.
Well, on the one hand, it's just not true. Trans folks are shot in great numbers and more trans folks of color. But then on the other hand, he is placing a premium on pain and suffering, and black men are targeted disproportionately. So it's offensive, but it's also insightful.
It's really hard, though, isn't it, for comedians to come right up to that line and then back off without offending the audience? It's almost as if they're working out their stuff on the stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Dave Chappelle aims to offend. And I think that many great comedians do and have, and it works because of their presentation and demeanor and intelligence. But the places in these two shows that fall flat are the parts that are offensive, but they're just also not funny. That, to me, is a shift in his work. He used to be able to present offensive and have it really be hilarious. But we're in a place now and in a time where we've moved past politically correct to just a cultural conversancy that we want, where we want to be mindful of how people identify in this fraught era of identity politics.
Chappelle himself will acknowledge that women are among his greatest critics. Here's a bit of Chappelle talking about having a woman yell at him during a show.
Does she think that I don't know that rape is wrong? Does she think that maybe I don't have empathy for Bill Cosby's alleged victims? And I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that technically
These are all still allegations, although I admit it looks very bad.
He spends a good chunk of one of the shows trying to reconcile the way he feels about Bill Cosby in light of the rape allegations against Cosby. Did it help you think about Cosby differently or about Chappelle differently?
It didn't help me think about Cosby differently. It helped me think about Chappelle thinking about Cosby differently and how Cosby could be this role model and hero to a young black male comedian coming up in the world. And Chappelle goes through this list of things that Cosby has done for black America, which is hard to argue. I'm not going to give away how that bit ends, but it's a very sad meditation and really actually somewhat moving.
So clearly he continues to wrestle with a lot of the very issues that are the subject of his comedy. So on balance, Rebecca Carroll, are you recommending The Chappelle Show?
I am recommending The Chappelle Show with the caveat that I'm not endorsing The Chappelle Show, but I am recommending it.
Rebecca Carroll is WNYC's culture critic. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you, Jamie.
Bonnie Prince, Charlie, are you a gentleman? Are you a member of Congress or something? Or are you the bloody Prince of Africa? But don't look at me, look right ahead, look straight ahead. I'll eat your ass up, boy.
You know, the Irish are not noted for their fondness for the colors.
Well, WIS was the first to report an assault outside a Five Points bar caught on camera. Take a look at this video of a USC student who says he was viciously attacked and choked unconscious.
Billie Jean Shaw reports that he wants his attacker to be held accountable. We warn you, some of the video is graphic.
This incident happened at Poorhouse Bar in Five Points St. Pat's weekend. According to the police reports, Ryan Chisholm was making sure his friend was not involved in a fist fight when he was pushed outside of the bar by security. He then said this happened, an attack by an unknown man. Chisholm says he's been in physical and emotional pain ever since.
This 10-second Snapchat clip shows several people watching as 21-year-old Ryan Chisholm is choked from behind, losing consciousness, and thrown to the ground.
I lost air. I thought I died. When I woke up, I didn't even know I hit the ground. I was just bleeding, like blood all over me.
Here's another angle. In this clip, you can see a better view of the aggressor, a white male wearing a white blazer covered in green clovers.
I've never seen him before in my life. It happened so quick. I didn't see him until I seen the video.
Chisholm says this stranger is now a part of his life every day as he is constantly reminded by the painful injuries he's caused.
All my teeth, when they hit the concrete, it just got pushed up in my gums. I fractured my jaw. That night in the hospital, I got about 13 to 14 stitches.
Columbia police are investigating the incident. The videos have been turned over to them as well. At this time, no suspect or person of interest has been identified.
This individual needs to be charged. What he did was commit a crime, and Poorhouse needs to be held accountable. There's a new bartender in town, and her name is Lady Justice. And she's serving up shots of justice, and those will be served with no chaser.
I put in several calls and social media messages to Poorhouse. I have not yet gotten a response. In the studio, Billie Jean Shaw, WIS News 10.
The full incident report on the case is on our website, WISTV.com.
The alleged killer could not imagine how the city of Charleston...
Live 5 has learned a North Charleston police officer was investigated and later demoted over a complaint of racial bias. The claim is tied to a parody of the song, What Does the Fox Say?
The parody, What Does the Black Say, was sent from the officer to a Facebook group. Karina Bolster has more on that investigation.
Officer David Winslet met with officials this morning behind closed doors at City Hall. Court documents we obtained show on January 10th of 2014, Winslet sent a YouTube link to the former group, the Chas Thug Life.
I don't remember the specific link or a message.
This audio interview with Winslet and the Professional Standards Bureau on February 9th of this year comes after the department received a complaint from Charleston County Solicitor Scarlett Wilson. Her office, along with the State Law Enforcement Division, investigated Chas Thug Life, eventually finding these private Facebook messages between them and Winslet. Winslet's message under investigation said, quote, "You guys have probably seen this, but if not, "It's quite entertaining," kind of touches on the recent events. The video link attached is to a parody of the song, "What Does the Fox Say?"
I know the link, I know the song, I know the video, but I don't know what I was alluding to.
The video references several racial stereotypes, especially stereotypes of the black community. It makes fun of African Americans, including the use of the N-word, a pow-pow phrase, which follows with an image of a man shooting a gun.
Do you see where they could have some concerns over a video like this?
I do.
Was there any malicious intent?
Absolutely.
On March 2nd, Winslet was notified of his demotion to community service officer. Documents filed by a member with the Professional Standards Bureau states the video link Winslet sent does not itself prove or show racial bias. In North Charleston, Karina Bolster, Live 5 News.
According to the Professional Standards Bureau, Winslet has no prior reported complaints of racial bias against him as a North Charleston officer. In 2012, he was shot in the line of duty while responding to a robbery where he was later presented the Purple Heart Award. Document states Solicitor Wilson filed the complaint because of concern for his ability to effectively testify in court based on the content of the video.
I want to be a cop.
The police union is calling for criminal prosecutions after a series of leaks of confidential disciplinary records. But WNYC's Robert Lewis reports that police are not so vocal about the leaking of confidential information about people killed by police.
For the second time in as many weeks, someone leaked records of civilian complaints against officers involved in high-profile killings of unarmed civilians. First, there was news that Officer Daniel Pantaleo had 7 civilian complaint review board cases before his fatal arrest of Eric Garner. Then came records on the officer who shot and killed Ramarley Graham in 2012. Both leaks made their way to the website Think Progress and then across the city, including New York One.
NYPD Officer Richard Hayes reportedly had an unusual number of complaints against him leading up to the deadly shooting that led to him quitting the department.
In response to the leaks, the police union has called for a criminal investigation and prosecution of whoever released the information. Section 50A of the state's civil rights law shields police disciplinary records from the public. A CCRB employee has already resigned over the leak. But Officer Richard Haste wasn't the only one to have confidential information released. It also happened to the teen he killed. Immediately after the 2012 shooting, news outlets started reporting about Ramarley Graham's prior arrests, but his family and their lawyer say those records were supposed to be sealed. Graham's mother, Constance Malcolm.
This is what they put out there in the public so people could just like, oh, he must be a thug. He had this record and stuff like that.
She felt like police were trying to demonize her son.
It was shocking because I didn't know that could happen because, you know, in court they tell you it's sealed, it can't be open.
Juvenile cases are generally sealed. And even if you're an adult, if the charges are dismissed or you're acquitted, those records are also supposed to be sealed under Criminal Procedure Law, Section 16050. Cynthia Conti Cook is a staff attorney in the Legal Aid Society's Special Litigation Unit.
The principle is innocent until proven guilty. And if you're not proven guilty or plead guilty, resulting in a conviction, the sealing laws protect people from having arrests on their records indefinitely.
But she says it's like clockwork. When someone is killed by police, old arrests are dredged up and made public.
If the police department wants to release the entire sealed arrest history and at the same time won't release all civilian complaints, for example, against that officer, they're trying to tip the scales of what the public is understanding about the people involved.
In their wrongful death lawsuit against the city, Ramarley Graham's family accused the NYPD of leaking sealed records. The city ultimately settled that lawsuit for $3.9 million. Family lawyer Jeff Emden says the prior arrests were irrelevant.
What does that have to do with whether or not he was wrongfully shot and whether the police were telling the truth of the circumstances under which he was shot? It's not unique to Ramarley. It was also done to Eric Garner.
Indeed. Shortly after a cop choked Garner during a bust for selling loose cigarettes, outlets started reporting that Garner had been arrested dozens of times, despite the fact most of those arrests didn't result in criminal convictions. This is Fox host Bill O'Reilly talking to former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani in December 2014.
And he had a long record. He knew the drill.
31 arrests.
Right.
Giuliani has a history of releasing dirt on people killed during interactions with the police. In 2000, he talked to reporters about the juvenile record of Patrick Dorismond, an unarmed man shot and killed by a plainclothes cop.
I'm not giving you a judgment. I don't know what happened. You don't know what happened. I do know that these are relevant facts. That Mr. Dorismond spent a good deal of his adult life punching people is a fact.
The city settled a wrongful death lawsuit in that case for more than $2 million. The NYPD and the police union did not respond to requests for comment on this story. Robert Lewis, WNYC News.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
Hey, yo, so listen. I watched a video yesterday that I really, really regret watching. It was posted online and somebody tagged me and said, this is something that you should have a look at. And it really made me sick to my stomach. The video is of a young man, a black man, lying on the ground outside of the Shoppers Drug Mart at York Lanes, which is the plaza at York University on Kiel. This man's lying on the ground and he's crying out for help. The man says, they have broken my leg. Please help me, to people who are standing by. Apparently, according to people who were there on the scene, this young man was confronted by what's called a loss prevention officer at the Shoppers Drug Mart. Fancy name for a security guard. The loss prevention officer allegedly tackled this man, and in the process of tackling him, twisted his leg and it bent the wrong way. I really regret watching this video because you can see that this man's leg is bent in an extremely awkward and wrong position that a human leg is not supposed to be in. And you can just imagine the agony that he is experiencing. The York United Black Students Alliance is the group that started putting all of this out there and bringing it to people's attention. Now, they wrote up what they understand happened in this situation, and I want to read you a section of the write-up here, because it says, an altercation ensued prior to eyewitnesses' arrival, where an officer who was hired by Shoppers Drug Mart and dressed in plain clothes tackled a student. What resulted was the student's leg being twisted at a 90-degree angle. Now, this is the important part. Quote, procedures are put in place in order to ensure the safety of the LPO, that's the loss prevention officer, as well as the students who frequent the store. These procedures were not followed. Instead of Toronto Police Services being called, the LPO executed their own brand of justice where they had no jurisdiction to do so. They are not paid to place their hands on folks who come in and out of the stores they are hired by, unquote. That's from the York United Black Students Alliance, who are actually calling for a boycott of Shoppers Drug Mart in the wake of this horrible incident. I contacted the Toronto police to find out what information they had on this situation. And Carolyn DeClute, who is a spokesperson there at Corporate Communications, did provide me with information that the police were actually notified about this incident, that they were dispatched there. And I asked if there was any arrest made. There actually was an arrest made of this situation, and it was arrest of the man who had his leg twisted. He was charged with four charges, this 25-year-old man, including assault with intent to resist and assault. I'm so sickened by this. I know that the other two charges, by the way, that the man was charged with were theft under $5,000 and possession of property obtained by crime. I hope his leg is not broken. He certainly said it was, and it really looked in the video like it was. But no one deserves to get their leg broken for the allegation of petty theft. And that loss prevention officer, as was mentioned in the write-up that I just read to you, really had no business putting his hands on this young man, and it certainly wasn't worth the consequence. But I think what's important about this story, because this is about Shoppers Drug Mart, where this happened. And by the way, I did reach out to Shoppers Drug Mart to ask if they had any comment on this, Have not received a response. They haven't posted anything on any social media. But let's talk about Shoppers Drug Mart, because this is an institution where people get profiled regularly walking around the stores shopping. And there have been a lot of cases about this, including a case here in Toronto where a black woman was awarded $8,000 by the Human Rights Tribunal because she was profiled and followed around the store by security. Shows like Marketplace on television have also done investigations where they sent people of color, indigenous people included, into Shoppers Drug Mart to see what would happen. And of course, those people are followed and trailed and surveilled by security who make it look like they're, you know, walking around and make it look like they're busying themselves somehow, but really they're following people. And I know that you might hear a story like this if you have a cold, cold heart. And you might think to yourself, if you go into a store and you try to take something, then you get whatever is coming to you. But this is a 25-year-old black man. Okay, so now I really hope that he's able to recover from his injuries. But that's the first problem, is that he's sustained what it looks like some incredibly serious injuries that could affect his whole life going forward. And then you have to deal with these criminal charges. So if you want to ruin another young black man's life over allegations that he took something minor from a store, then this is a great story for you. But if you're like the rest of us saying, how in the world is the punishment here proportional to what he's accused of having done? We need to look at places like Shoppers Drug Mart, where this keeps happening, where there's disproportionate attention being paid. And yeah, the racists out there will say, well, he was stealing something, so it's right to follow the black people around the store because the police said he was stealing something. I know that that's the attitude that a lot of people have. And as I said, this story is probably a great story for them. But the consequence is what really concerns me. It's the consequence that happened to this young black person. If a loss prevention officer saw him and he believed he was taking something from the store, to enact his own justice that ended up breaking this man's leg when really he didn't have to engage with him at all. It's that choice that makes us talk about racism and systemic discrimination, because there always has to be the harshest penalty when a black person is involved. That's what this has come to. The story is that this young man was confronted by a security officer at the York University's Shoppers Drug Mart who believed he was taking something. And the security guard tackled this young man and bent his leg 90 degrees in the wrong direction. It certainly looks in the video, as I said, that this man's leg was broken. But on top of that, now he has these very serious charges, including assault, which could really ruin him going forward. I'm very familiar with the talk radio, you get what you deserve, you should have thought of that before, etc. crowd. I know all y'all, and I've heard all of those things before, and we hear those things in our society every day. But when a young black person, this man is black, when he can't get a job because of assault charges for somebody who should never have touched him, when he can't move on in his life because he tried to allegedly take something and then got into this mix, are all of you folks going to be happy? No, you're going to find another reason to hate on a black person who you say is not achieving in society. But the consequences for us have to be so hard. And, you know, this is always potential, because we know from so many stories, including the one I cited earlier, that security guards are trained to follow black and other people of color around their stores. So if anybody's going to get the harsh treatment, it's going to be us. This young man has to appear in court. He's innocent until proven guilty. But I'm more worried about his injuries. And I'm very worried if these charges are going to stick and go through, what happens to this young man's life? And over what? What was he accused of doing that was so bad that this is the outcome? I find it beyond ridiculous. Mitch in Burlington. Hello, Mitch.
How are you doing?
I'm okay.
You know, let me turn that down. I feel terrible for this young man, but there are four charges against him, and all we know is what happened after the store. I would like to know if it's possible that he was just confronted by the security guard. You can call him whatever you want, loss prevention engineer and whatever. is it possible that he confronted the guy, assaulted him, and because of that he was injured? Or is there security footage that says, hey, he was minding his own business with stolen property, albeit, and he was tackled and injured? It's possible that I'm a trained security specialist. I haven't done it in several years, but
yeah.
I was a very high-level security agent in Montreal, and I taught. And yes, very often we're going to confront someone and say, hey, without putting hands on them, hey, put that back or don't come back in the store or whatever it's going to be, without getting the police involved. And I've seen agents get attacked for that. Well, the agent has to fight back.
Yeah.
So you're making it sound like, now, if he was profiled, that's terrible. And I'm a minority, but I'm not a visible minority. I think profiling is awful. But let's take that aside. He was obviously, he had taken something that wasn't his.
That's what is alleged. I can't prove that either way. I don't know.
I agree. Alleged, and for better or for worse, whether it's true or not, that's what started the incident.
Right.
Who took the first shot? You're making it sound like this man was injured because he was a young black man.
No, I'm only reporting on what I have heard from people who were there and who, in this case, recorded the aftermath of it and who were talking to this young man. And, you know, listen, Mitch, I'm going to move on, but thank you very much for the call. I got other folks here waiting. I don't know what started the altercation, but I don't think that the security guard should lay hands on a person inside the store. And it sounds like there is a policy in place to prevent exactly this from happening so that incidents like this don't occur. That's what it sounds like the policy is there for. Not that you want to confront somebody and take them down because you think they took something. Tim in Caledon also used to be a loss prevention officer. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hi. Yes, loss prevention, security, whatever. You're paid to protect the employees and the merchandise of a privately owned company. One mistake that you have made is that the Criminal Code of Canada allows any Canadian citizen, if seeing a crime being committed, to place a person under, and we call it citizen's arrest.
That's right.
If you are seeing this happen and you do place someone under arrest, it is not any different than a police officer placing that person under arrest. Now, the person has not done anything wrong unless they have left that premises with the merchandise and they haven't paid for it. They have then committed, or they are alleged to have committed, theft. At that point, the security officer or any other person who saw him select the merchandise, leave the store with not paying for it, can place under arrest.
Now, can I ask you, though, Tim, because he's charged here. One of the charges is with intent to resist.
Yes.
And it sounds like that is, you know, specific to the fact that this was a security guard, because I don't know if that charge would be given if you were having a confrontation with a normal civilian. It sounds like the fact that it's a security guard and you were struggling with the security guard.
No.
Is that not the reason? Or you can tell me.
Okay. For instance, let's say you see someone, you know they're impaired and they're driving a car, and you pull them out of the car and they're impaired. You'd say to them, you are under arrest for impaired driving. You, Desmond, just Joe Desmond, if that person strikes you, they are now going to be charged with all the things that this alleged shoplifter has been charged with.
I see.
And that had happened to me in my career a couple of times, where I told someone, you have to approach them, you have to touch them, and you have to say you are under arrest. And once you have done that, if they assault you or whatever, they are resisting arrest. And that's right in the criminal code. You can look it up if you
want. I take your word for it. Can I ask you one more thing before I let you go,
sure,
though? Do you think that this outcome is proportionate to what this man is accused of doing? A broken leg and four criminal charges? over something that was inside of a Shoppers?
It sounds like the security, well, he would have had to have been outside or he wouldn't have been charged.
But, okay.
No, it does sound fairly violent, although I got beat up pretty bad a couple of times and put in hospital by shoplifters. So you don't know who you're dealing with. You're not carrying any weapons. You're using your wits. He probably tried to tackle him like a football player would.
Yeah.
And it got really ugly.
Tim, I got to run. Thank you very much for all this info. You know, I know that people say, how do you know race was a factor? How do you know this? How do you know that? Are you sure race was involved? He was just doing his job. The fact of the matter is that the worst outcomes for situations like this keep happening to us as black people. And I really wish that whoever made that decision to put their hands on this young man had not done so, because they've literally ruined his life over an accusation of petty theft. They've ruined him in terms of his health. And they've put these charges on him, which, even if he's cleared of them, have a really big stigmatizing effect, getting arrested and having to go to court. It's not worth it. For all you law and order people out there, this is not the society that you want. It's not fair and helpful to disenfranchise people like this over something allegedly so small. But this is the reason it's happening, is because we set up a system that is so hard on people, and then we have to justify it when something like this happens.
Mona, Pam, and Monica, Harriet's granddaughters. March, we are told, is Women's History Month. But we're here to celebrate the lives of several revolutionary women, but also to recognize a simple, undeniable truth. Without women, there would be no months to celebrate, for women gave birth to the world. Harriet Tubman was one of the greatest freedom fighters in history, for she brought forth hundreds of souls from the prison house of slavery, bringing them north of the dreaded Mason-Dixon line. And after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, bringing them to the far north of Canada. I say that these three women, Mona, Pam, and Monica, are like Harriet, for they all fight for freedom almost every day against great odds, and they keep on pushing no matter what. Ramona Africa was a young college student trying to learn the law at Temple University. She was invited to come to City Hall to actually see what went on in the MOVE trial. She was wholly unprepared for what she saw, for nothing she read in law books could explain the naked brutality of the law as she saw practiced in City Hall courtrooms. She witnessed the railroading of MOVE men and women, and it turned her away from her chosen profession of lawyer. In short, what she saw MOVE members experience in pretrial hearings and in trial repulsed her. Indeed, it radicalized her. She entered court as a mild-mannered college student. What she saw and heard turned her into a committed revolutionary Ramona Africa MOVE member. But that wasn't all. As she came closer to MOVE and the teachings of John Africa, and as she worked for the freedom of MOVE members, she didn't know that the government was planning what they considered MOVE's final solution. On May 13, 1985, she found out, the world found out, when city, state, and federal government agencies conspired to bomb MOVE from a helicopter. When the fires had eaten its full, 11 men, women, and children were either shot or burned to death. Their dogs were killed. An entire city block looked like Dresden, the eastern German city bombed in World War II. Mona, burned badly on her arms, was one of two survivors of the firebombing in West Philadelphia. She was also the only person ever imprisoned for riot. It's fitting that she never believed in the law that she once studied. She believed in revolution. She believes in it today. Pam Africa was a lighthearted party girl until she met MOVE. They were neighbors of hers. She wasn't really into them until she saw them attacked by police. She followed her heart and warmed to them. The closer she got, the more she found herself targeted and threatened. She would not ignore what she saw. She couldn't. She didn't run away. She moved closer to MOVE and to John Africa. Pam Africa, guided by her powerful heart and the power of her love for Move people became a Move person. Move became her brothers and sisters, her family. They respected her fighting spirit so much that Move's founder, John Africa, named her Minister of Confrontation. She attended court hearings and was constantly faced with threats of violence by cops for her Move advocacy. In defense of others, she's had her teeth knocked out, her leg broken, but she kept on scrapping. She isn't just a fighter. When she speaks, she sets crowds on fire. She is a master organizer. She gets them on the move. For the young generation of activists, such as Black Lives Matter, she is known respectfully and affectionately as Mama Pam. She is a mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. And like Harriet Tubman, her mind, her soul, her fists are stuck on freedom. Monica Moorhead is a leading member of the Workers' World Party, a national Marxist collective. Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, authors of the Communist Manifesto, wrote, "The communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things." It is a dictum that Monica and her comrades take to heart. They work with a wide range of people, trying to organize them into movements of resistance, from repression against labor unions to a new wave of women's movements, from the scourge of mass incarceration, from the cancer of police repression in Black and Latino America, to the state terrorism encapsulated in the racist death penalty, from imperial wars in Iraq to the drug wars against innocents abroad. Monica and her comrades have been there, joining with and giving voice to movements which seek to build new worlds. Monica comes from a long line of resistance to racism and repression. She was born in Jim Crow era Alabama, the granddaughter of school teachers and daughter of two college professors. As a high school student and member of the school band, she caused a ruckus by refusing to play Dixie. As a young woman, she was a supporter of the Prisoner Solidarity Committee and sold copies of the Black Panther newspaper. Her parents were part of the Montgomery bus boycott led by Reverend Martin Luther King. Monica remembered her mother, a brilliant musician, being thrown out of a whites-only bathroom by cops. From a youth of resistance to a life of resistance, that's the story of Monica Moorhead. She is an editor of the revolutionary weekly Workers' World. She's co-authored and edited several books, including Marxism, Reparations in the Black Freedom Struggle, and the reprint of A Voice from Harper's Ferry by Black revolutionary Osborne Anderson, who accompanied John Brown on his raid on a federal armory to arm Black slaves. In 2000, she helped organize an historic Free Mumia rally at Madison Square Garden. And in 2016, she ran for the U.S. president on the Workers' World ticket. Who says revolutionary women don't rock the world? Women build the world. They surely got a right to rock it. Harriet's granddaughters, Mona Africa, Pam Africa, and Monica Moorhead. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
One night, we were, my assistant and I, and he was another Black guy, because the white guys just couldn't go out at night. That's my assistant and I were out someplace, and we got to the corner of Grand River and Joy Road. I'll never forget this. And all of a sudden, a convoy just surrounds us. There were state police, there were National Guardsmen, there were local police, there were sheriffs and everything. And I had fancy credentials as a federal official, and they were here in my inside coat pocket. Out of the car, they scream, out of the car, out of the car. And you emerge from a car, and you're two Black guys, and you're surrounded by like 20 or 30 white men with guns, all of them pointing them guns at you. And they're all scared too. And so I just say, scream Justice Department at the top of your lungs. And we scream, Justice Department, Justice Department, Justice Department. And they're screaming at us, you know. And I really, at that point, I think I'm going to die. And I was 35 years old, same age as my father when he died. And my father's last words were 35 and through. And I said, 35 and through, at the corner of Grand River and Joy Road. I wasn't afraid. I just said, damn. You know, I was disappointed, really.
Roger Wilkins wrote that he was an explorer who sailed as far out into the white world as a black man of his generation could sail. Wilkins was a civil rights lawyer, a newspaper columnist, and an educator. He died Sunday in Maryland at age 85, and NPR's Andrew Limbong has this appreciation.
As a young man with a good job at a New York law firm in 1957, Roger Wilkins didn't need to get involved in the civil rights movement. But he told NPR in 2011 he saw what was going on in Little Rock, Arkansas, as Central High School was being desegregated.
And then I would read Baldwin, and with his sizzling, dramatic language, I got a new depth in my black soul.
That's James Baldwin he's talking about.
And so you couldn't say to yourself, well, let those kids do it. If you were alive, you had to say, I want to do something. I want to become involved. This is important.
Roger Wilkins was born in Kansas City, Missouri in 1932. As a kid, his one-room segregated school was shut down, so he had to be bused across town to an all-black elementary school. When his father died, he and his mother moved to New York. His uncle was Roy Wilkins, who led the NAACP.
My uncle lived in a building on Sugar Hill. W. Dubee, Du Bois lived there, and Kenneth Clark lived there, and Thurgood Marshall lived there. So when Roy would invite me to dinner, you know, all these giants are in the room.
He learned what he could from them and became a lawyer, ending up in Washington, D.C., working under President Johnson to help calm racial tensions in the country. Wilkins made a mid-career shift to journalism. He wrote influential columns for the Washington Post, which, along with other reporting by the paper, helped bring down the Nixon administration and win the paper a Pulitzer. He also wrote about the smaller stories, like the sort of loneliness you feel when you're a first or one of a few. For example, an early piece of his was called A Black at the Gridiron Dinner. The Gridiron Dinner is a fancy pants event for Washington, D.C. politicians and media types. He wrote, quote, "There is something about an atmosphere like that that is hard to define, but excruciatingly easy for a black man to feel. It is the heavy, almost tangible, clearly visible, broad assumption that in places where it counts, America is a white country." Roger Wilkins' last job was at George Mason University, where he taught history and American culture. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Nelson Mandela, a great man, no doubt about that. But one thing about that greatness, it tended to overshadow some of the other leaders in South Africa's anti-apartheid movement, like Ahmed Kathrada. He was an Indian South African and a fellow member of the African National Congress with Mandela. Both men were jailed for 26 years by the apartheid regime. Both served much of that time on Robben Island. But as Kathrada once told the BBC, they were treated differently there because of their different backgrounds.
I got more sugar than Mandela. I got a little more meat, a little more fish than Mandela. I got a loaf of bread every day. Mandela got no bread. It was a microcosm of how apartheid applied in the whole country.
When Kathrada was released in 1989, he became President Mandela's political advisor and then went on to dedicate his life to civil rights. Kathrada died this morning at the age of 87. My BBC colleague in Johannesburg, Milton Nkosi, joins us. How did Kathrada become involved in the anti-apartheid movement in the beginning?
So Ahmed Kathrada, at an early age, he started joining the anti-apartheid movement. He joined the Indian Congress and the Young Communist League, and eventually, as a young lad, he met with Mandela, and together they formed a team, and they were working very hard to fight the white minority regime.
Why were the struggles of black South Africans so important to him?
Because Ahmed Kathrada, under apartheid, he was still categorized as a black person, even though he was of Indian descent. So you've got to remember structurally the way apartheid worked. So at the top of the ladder were white people. At the second level, you had Indians. The third level, you had mixed race people known as coloreds. And at the bottom, we had black Africans. So Ahmed Kathrada found it completely unacceptable that Africans were treated as second-class citizens in their own country of birth.
Yeah, on that point, I mean, he said he dedicated his life to deracializing the anti-apartheid struggle. Can you explain what that means?
Because Indians had a semi-comfortable deal from the apartheid government, even though they were still below the whites, but they were above the coloreds and the blacks. And therefore, some Indians decided not to do anything about it because they had access to better schools, better parks, better public amenities, better health facilities. So there are some Indian people who decided just to toe the line, enjoy the privileges that they were given, and did not fight the struggle along black Africans. So what he did, he elevated the level of the struggle. He said, this is an injustice to all of us. Therefore, we will all join. We cannot leave it to the Africans who are at the bottom of the ladder. In other words, the Africans had now Indians amongst them. They had white people amongst them. And therefore, the struggle became a universal fight for human rights.
After he was released from prison, from Robben Island, he actually went back to Robben Island and was a tour guide.
That's correct. What Ahmed Kathrada decided to do to fight the demons of racial oppression, he decided that it would be spiritually cleansing for him if he kept on taking people who are visiting South Africa, especially prominent leaders, to Robben Island prison and tell them the story over and over again of what they experienced when they were prisoners. And one of his most prominent visitors was President Barack Obama, who was with his family there. And Ahmed Kathrada took him to his own cell. Wow. And I remember hearing him explain to President Obama that one of the things you miss when you are in prison is the sound of a baby. You long just to hear a voice of a baby, a crying baby. And President Obama was quite visibly moved by that anecdote.
My colleague Milton Nkosi, South Africa Bureau Chief for the BBC. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
We're going to be talking about colonialism and medicine in this hour. And our interest was piqued by what I really thought was an excellent essay written for The Con Mag, theconmag.co.za. That's an online portal, and it is run by Naren Tulsi. And there was a really, really interesting, fascinating, deeply historical piece written by Dr. Matthew Wilhelm Solomon, who's going to join us in a second. Matthew is a writing fellow on the Migration and Health Project Southern Africa at the University of Witwatersrand, based at the African Center for Migration and Society. And I'm also going to be joined by a medical historian from UCT, Dr. Carla Semperis, who's a senior lecturer in medical humanities at UCT. But what I loved about Matthew's piece, which piqued our interest to have him really just voice the narrative that he started here, is that we often don't pay enough attention, and I'm guilty of this myself, in our public discourse, to the treasures that lie in the archives and learn from history, both as a matter of sensitivity to truth and evidence, and also so that we don't talk through our behinds when we enter very important contemporary debates, such as debates about the legacy of colonialism. What is truth and what is faction? And that's very important. So let's just see whether we have them on the line. Matt is somewhere else in the universe. I don't even know what time it is there, but I am very grateful.
Greetings.
How's it, Matt?
It's 5 o'clock in the morning in Brazil, which is very, very early.
Also joining us, Matt, in our Cape Town studio is Carla. And Carla, of course, as you know, also does excellent work when it comes to the history around diseases, and as some of the anthropological and historical issues here are really, really important. Carla, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Good morning. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show.
I'm just going to kick us off with a basic question, Matt. If I have a look at your piece, and my producers and I were trying to distill what some of the big themes are, there's a number of them that come through. Let's jump straight into the first one. A lot of people think that from an instrumental point of view, colonialism gifted us all sorts of benefits and breakthroughs when it comes to medicine. And the first theme that you cast the spotlight on is, in fact, about colonialism and the spread of diseases.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the kind of founding myths, liberal myths of colonialism, that colonists brought with them advanced medical care, and you know this, but in fact, for the first 4 or 5 centuries of colonialism, Europeans didn't even have advanced medical care. Their medical care was very rudimentary, and primarily what they brought were diseases. And if you look at the history of Latin America, the Americas, even the Cape, these diseases wiped out huge proportions of the population because of lack of local immunity. And this is a very important thing to acknowledge, is that you have 4 centuries of mass death from disease. You didn't have good medical care. And what we think of as modern medical care is really a 20th century phenomena, late 19th century, and this took place centuries into the colonial project.
Carla, I want to bring you in here. One of the points that you've made in our pre-discussion with my team is, of course, that colonialism had negative effects on health in some of the settler colonies in relation to spreading genes and also undoing good health practices. Unravel that for us.
So I think one of the central
context.
Looking at behavior in context.
Context here, there's 2 key points associated with this. If people live together, somebody knows how to heal. Okay, nobody has a community in which there isn't somebody who has healing capacity. What we've seen happen is that particular narratives of healing have taken primacy because of, you know, political power differentials. And so you see that there was an arrogance often associated with ideas around medical practice that either deliberately failed to ignore existing practices that were in fact really useful and really good, or just assumed that there could be no such thing as medical knowledge that, or healing knowledge that was of any use. So one of the examples perhaps for this is that the villagization projects in East Africa, for example, saw a rapid increase in trypanosomiasis, or sleeping sickness. And that was directly the result of moving people out of a system in which there had been essentially a way that people had lived to ensure that there was increased exposure to trypanosomiasis, to ensure that if you lived somewhere, eventually by the time you were sort of a teenager, you had immunity. You then have the land grabs, you have the forced removals of peoples, and you start seeing an increase in diseases because existing structures that were in place to address various health concerns were just roughshod run over by a colonial project. So there are numbers of examples of that, and not just in terms of sleeping sickness, but even with things like, you know, the smallpox epidemic. So you have, as Matt has so rightly pointed out, you have both the introduction of germs, and, you know, of course, guns, germs, and steel tend to be the way this is understood. But you also have existing systems of knowledge either appropriated when necessary or claimed and unwritten out of the existing history by people who, as Matt has said, were trying to make themselves a profession.
Carla, I want to stay with that. Is that why you were so passionate also in pointing out the fact that the other problem with this kind of narrative, as you put it, quote unquote, is that it assumes a history of medicine that is predicated almost exclusively on Europe? So there's also here a kind of epistemic erasure of local knowledge.
Absolutely. But it extends beyond that. It's also a massively narrow-focused engagement on understandings of history. So, you know, we call or we refer in controversial and debatable terms to the notion of Western biomedicine because it follows a particular trajectory, but it didn't spring from the grounds or wasn't sent down by lightning, you know, to one particular part of the globe. To speak of history in such a flat manner It removes a number of things. So if we think about what we define as Western biomedicine, it removes the relationship between the Enlightenment and the Islamic Golden Age. Mm. We know that in what is referred to as the Islamic Golden Age, between the 8th and the 13th century, there were Arabic and Islamic scholars who were well advanced in medical practice and knowledge. They had collated a lot of the classical knowledge that had been produced in the previous empires, Rome, Greece, and so forth, and were engaging in ideas and discussions. We know that there was contact between Islamic scholars and scholars, well, you know, emerging scholars in the Renaissance and then in the Enlightenment. So, and of course, the Islamic scholars themselves had got knowledge from other places. Mm. So this assumption that there is direct trajectory between, you know, colonial medics of the 19th century and Greece without anything else in between is just erroneous, and it flattens a far more complicated knowledge history.
Matthew, you pointed out as well, weaving into what Carla has just said, that colonialism, besides introducing non-native diseases, colonialism also facilitated the rapid spreading of those diseases. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it's just to pick up on what Carla has already pointed out. You had forced labor migration and very poor living conditions, which are very conducive to the spread of communicable disease like tuberculosis, and particularly when colonial industrialization took place and you had the land grabs. I mean, this is the case in South Africa in particular, but also elsewhere. You had forced removals from rural areas, colonized populations moving into cities under very poor living conditions. And these conditions were really conducive to diseases like tuberculosis. And so particularly the forced labor system actively spread disease and raised levels of epidemic disease.
Carla, the next big thing that I'd like us to touch on is in terms of how medical research and experimentation happened. There's a point in which, there's a point in the essay by Matt where he asks a very poignant question. He says, one should invert the question that a certain politician had asked about, you know, colonialism's gift to us, and ask the question, but for colonialism, would certain advances have been possible? Mm. Tell the public about examples that are very typical of the kinds of experimentation that happened in colonial Africa, and maybe even still goes on, I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in some ways this connects directly with what Matt has just been speaking about. Medicine in a colonial context, and whether you want to talk of that as colonial medicine or medicine in the colonies, is in some sense a part of a web of acquisition and the maintenance of power and privilege, and that played into any number of things: the stealing of land, mining, military, urbanization, forced labor, control of reproduction, population movement, and also control of who was allowed to give birth, when, where, and how. And undermining and central to a whole point of that was how people were used as forms of medical evidence to argue very specific ideas of difference. Mm. And of course, the example that most directly connects to South Africa is Sarah Bartman and the experiences of Sarah Bartman being taken from the Cape Colony, taken initially by a ship surgeon. One of the two men who took her was a ship surgeon, to the UK to be displayed. And then after a public furore around her being displayed in a country that had declared that there would be no more trade in human bodies, her then being taken to France, where she again performed and was brought out as a kind of interesting specimen of humanity. But in both her life and her death, her body became the central evidence. Parts of her body became central evidence upon which one of the leading scientists of the time built his argument about how there was a hierarchy of people and how Sarah Bartman represented a missing link between apes and people. So bodies, especially black women's bodies, have often been the actual physical sites of cutting, experimenting, displaying for the sake of a certain kind of knowledge to be presented. And of course, Sara was not the only person to have experienced this. There were several equivalent, what were referred to at the time as Hottentot Venuses, not all of whom ended up in labs or in surgeries. But we know also, for example, that the genocide that happened amongst Herero people in what is now Namibia, that several of the skulls of people were sent to metropoles, you know, to Germany, to France, to the UK, and used as evidence of difference at a time, and this is kind of in the later colonial periods, when there was an active mechanism to try and use medicine and science to prove difference, because doing that would allow the perpetuation of certain types of power and privilege over other people. So we know that several skulls were sent right around the world. Of course, Hinsa's head here was sent. We know that there have been cases, if you want to shift focus outside of the African continent, around the Hela cells. You know, Henrietta Lacks' life in much later on in the United States, where cells from her body were used and regenerated for medicine without any permissions gained, because there wasn't really an idea that there needed to be permissions or that there were ethics involved in this. We know about the Tuskegee experiment, where particularly black men who had syphilis or other STIs were left without treatment to kind of see the effects of what would happen if you left things happen. So there is a long, long history of the just, and before we even get to anything else, just actual physical bodies of people in colonized spaces forming part of a medical database, essentially, used to maintain certain ideas of power and privilege.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 1st, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in, share your views, thoughts, counter-racist suggestions. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I want to remind listeners, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner of the page. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported in the program 8+ years. Hope the cows has helped you get a better understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be white. That's it. Just two quick things, and then we will get to folks who dialed in if you have commentary, things you would like to share. Number one, Roger Wilkins passed away this week, attorney, black journalist, victim of racism, white supremacy. I saw a number of great columns. I think I posted one about his tenure at the New York Times. He was there for 5 years, and he talked about racism. I would be interested if the great Bill Roden has any comments on Roger Wilkins, because I think they would have been both working at the New York Times together during a brief period. I'd be interested to ask Mr. Roden that. Anyway, the segment that you heard on Roger Wilkins, he was the one where it started off. It said that he felt like a black male who was sailing off into the big white world to see as far as, you know, what was out there and as much as he could do. The lead up to that segment It was Roger Wilkins. He was the one where he said he was out. He was talking for context. He was talking about the so-called riots in Detroit in the 1960s. And he said that he was out and he got stopped and he was surrounded by these 20 white guys with guns. And he thought he was going to die in 35 and done. I think it's important that he said there were no white people out on the street at night. Right. And to me, it suggested that it was not safe. Right. Like black people were, you know, there was such chaos and black people were doing so many things that, you know, white people just could not be out there. But then he comes back and he says that he is surrounded by 20 white people, almost two dozen of them, who were clearly outside. And they did not seem to be in any way intimidated, frightened, startled by two Negroes. It seemed like they were able to handle that situation quickly. And if they wanted to kill those two black people, even from the Justice Department, it seems they could have done that in a few seconds. And that would have just been that. That's what I mean about being just making sure that we're being honest. That would seem to be contradictory statements unless I'm misinformed or not understanding things accurately. The other anecdote that I wanted to share, and I cannot let it slide, that segment at the end. Wow. I listen to a lot of talk radio, but I have been listening to South African talk radio for about almost 5 years now because of listeners, cows listeners in South Africa who have called in. They called in and participated in the compensatory call-in, which is saying a lot because it is a substantial time difference. The compensatory call-in, I think right now, in South Africa, let's see, it's a 9-hour time difference. If I can get my math together, that would make it, I think, about 4 a.m. for what time it is in South Africa, if I'm correct on that. But whatever, I mean, super late. We've had folks tune in from all over the world, but some of our listeners from over there recommended Talk Radio 702 because they did a lot of segments talking about white supremacy. That piece at the end, Cape Talk 702, about could have just been medical apartheid, the South African perspective. And that segment was about an hour. I played about 15 minutes, stunning anybody who was with us for Harriet Washington's medical apartheid. Wow. The only thing, the last thing I'll say before we get to callers, I had a fascinating incident happen this week to Gus T. I wrote about it on Facebook and got such a lively response. I said I would make sure I mentioned it on the compensatory call-in. I'm sure some of the people that were on the Facebook thread might dial in or what have you. So I moved at the early part of the year, and my new living situation it has put me in a much more domestic environment, right? Like the news situation, I'm with a black mom, like a brand new mom, like days ago, mom. In fact, I was there when her water broke, which has just been fascinating, and having a lot of conversations with a first-time black mother about her fears and how she experienced racism as a pregnant mom and now as a mom, just with a newborn child, how she experiences racism. And just, it's been fascinating. Lots of learning opportunities. But it has put me in a more domestic setting, right? I'm adding this for important context for the story. When I say in a more domestic setting, like I fried chicken yesterday. I've never fried chicken in my life, like ever. And I fried chicken that I guess ended up, there were no leftovers, so I guess it was not that bad. And fried squash, which I just learned like days ago, is not a vegetable. And the fried squash also turned out, it was like a battered, not a cooking show, but that turned out well as well. But this much more domestic, even holding children. I mean, man, I have never really spent a whole lot of time around young, like newborn children. And I'm not a people person in general, curmudgeon. So to have settings where I'm settled in to watch Walking Dead and have literally a, you know, 3-day-old thrust in my lap. Like, you got to hold the baby. It's like, what are you? I'm trying to watch this. Like, it's just been a fascinating change. So I add that for context. Some things have been normalized for me, like holding small children. Now, in the new living situation, there is a household on the same block with a white mom. She has non-white children and non-white children with a non-white male, cowbell. And so we see them. We see the children. They'll be outside playing and, you know, the whole nine. I see them on a regular basis. There's a little non-white girl. She's like 2. And if I had to pick, she looks like Raven Simone. If folks remember what Raven Simone looked like when she was younger, right? That's about what she looks like. So very, very pleasant. She speaks every time that I see her. And I have seen and spent time with her before, like considerable time where she was outside and just hanging out. So I've seen her for a while now. So I'm sitting on the porch in the rocking chair, just enjoying my day. It's spring, so it's warmer. Just having a grand old time by myself. The little 2-year-old, she's outside. She's coming down the sidewalk. Oh, she waves. Oh, okay, what's up? Da, da, da. Of course, her suspected race soldier mother is there. And so a little 2-year-old, she comes up. And I'm sitting in the rocking chair. So she's playing and just running around on the porch and doing her thing. And she climbs in my lap. Now, by this time, other people have come. Like the moment that I had time in the rocking chair on the porch to myself, like the whole universe converged on the porch. So the little 2-year-old, her white mother, other black people, others, just everybody, whoo, all arrives. And I think even the mailman stopped while, you know, all of this sadness. So just all of these folks have gathered now on the porch area. The little girl hops in my lap and her mom thinks this is just the cutest. Everybody. So that's, oh, that's so cute. Bah, bah, bah. And I'm thinking, like, I don't really, what is going on? Like, what is going on? Now, like I said, because I have been holding small children more of late, you know, this is much more normalized than it would have been at any other point in my life. I would have been, you know, really, really, I probably would have gotten up or something. But like I said, it's, you know, Gus is hosting radio programs and holding children these days. That's, you know, and frying chicken, I guess. So the little girl is sitting there in the rocker and she just thinks this, I think just the rocking chair in and of itself is an attraction. So the white mom says, oh, she can feel your blackness. Now, I thought at that moment, now, we have had the conversation before about, is it significant if a non-white person has a white parent? And I've said every time, no exception, yes, that is hugely significant. I'm not saying that, you know, to talk bad about the non-white person, to call them names, to not listen to what they have to say. I'm not implying that they can't do constructive and great work to help end racism, white supremacy. All I'm saying is that, oh, that is significant, relevant information that this person has a white parent that could have a variety of influence, impact on their behavior, even if I am interacting with this person, as is the case in this child that has hopped in my lap in the rocking chair. So I continue to think about this, and I said, man, under any other circumstances, if this child was white, this would not have happened. Like, woof. Like, I would have given the most vicious stiff arm, like, whap out, like, back up off, like, whoa, what is going on? Like, it would have been a completely different response if this child was white. I do not hang out with white children, white people in general. Like, none of this would be happening. And I thought, like, is that, you know, grounds to say, hey, I can't even be cordial with this 2-year-old. And so I gave it some thought. I thought about it. I even talked about this with other non-white people. And even people said that. People said that on the Facebook page, made great observations about, you know, hey, I would not allow my child to be on, you know, another person like that. And, you know, that's just incorrect all the way around. And if the normal code is that you do not have contact with race soldiers' children, then that should be what the code is. And even people saying that they think sometimes race soldiers skillfully use their non-white offspring as a way to get other victims to lower their defenses so that they can infiltrate. All tremendous observations, all of them valid, I think. The conclusion I came to is I don't see the 2-year-old child. I don't see her father. I hope he is involved and, you know, is having great, healthy, nourishing contact with her. But I don't see him. I just see the race soldier mom. So if she can have constructive contact with a non-white person, I think that that's valid. I think that's reason enough to be cordial to her. And there's no way that that means that I have to sit out and just kick it with white mom. That means that I will just have to be on my counter-racist grind, and I will think of questions that I can ask while I'm kicking it and being nice with the 2-year-old. I said I am very square with that, and I will just report back on exchanges. I've already been thinking of a few questions that I can ask, and not even trying to be, you know, adversarial or, you know, anything like how many crackers are we going to have to kill to end racism? Not even thinking of anything like that. Just, you know, questions I would be curious about. Has it been a problem you having a child with a non-white person? Like, you know, questions like that, too, where I can actually get information. I will update. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, that way everyone gets an opportunity to speak. I will prompt about that. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be great, just to help us maintain the quality of the broadcast. Again, if we could not use metaphors for the compensatory call-in, I think racists, they will deliberately use metaphors, analogies, make comparisons that are not accurate. They will equate two things that are not equivalent at all. I think a lot of times victims, we have been trained by racists, educated by them, so we picked up many of their habits. But I think also myself, you know, also we are still learning and we have not come to conclusions about certain things. We're still trying to gather our concepts and how we want to articulate our views. And sometimes we employ a metaphor to express our ideas, and sometimes the metaphors, the analogies, they do not minimize confusion. They add more confusion, and they're inaccurate. They promote incorrectness. So if we could just make an effort to be as explicit, as simple, as direct as possible with what it is we would like to say, that would be appreciated, and I will prompt about that as well. Thank you kindly. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Greetings to everyone on the line. Domestic guest. That's interesting. The clip where the young male in, I believe it's South Carolina, was terrorized. There's a new bartender in town, and her name is Lady Justice. Just tacky, white antics. But the main thing I wanted to speak on this evening was, I might be late on this information, but Dylan Roof will not be put to death. I read an article on Atlanta Black Star where they were quoting, I guess, the prosecutor, and they just kept saying that it was an insurance policy. And I found that really odd, a really odd term to use, an insurance policy, that he, you know, because he's tried in the state and he's avoided the death penalty on the state, that he will be, you know, basically put in federal prison. He cannot be put to death for his terror, terrorist act. But yeah, I got really, really angry when I saw that. I had to really check my emotions and remember that that is the system of white supremacy at work. But yeah, this, the idea that this one person gets to live out the remainder of his life, and then we don't know what could possibly happen in the future. So there's no like guarantee. Everybody's campaign is an insurance policy that, you know, he won't be out and about to be a terrorist toward anyone else, I guess. But, you know, anything could happen in the future. And the fact that he gets to see it, whereas he took that possibility from 9 people, is just infuriating. But yeah, that's all I wanted to speak on. Thanks for listening. I'm in my line.
Appreciate that. I saw that report today. I think it came out yesterday, but I saw it today. My understanding, and other people that they saw it, you can inform us, that Dylan Roof was already convicted and sentenced to the death penalty for his federally, the federal trial that they had that concluded at the end of 2016. The new information was that he also was going to be prosecuted in state court, and they also were going to pursue the death penalty, but that they announced what the caller just shared, that they're not going to pursue the death penalty. He's just going to get a life sentence. He's agreed to plead guilty, and he's going to get a life sentence in exchange. They won't pursue the death penalty. This doesn't vacate the death penalty sentence that he got in federal court, but they even acknowledged within the article that there will probably be appeals and other court cases and what have you. Like, it could be years, if ever, before they execute him. But he still does have the death penalty conviction from federal court. The new news was just that the state court, he's going to plead guilty. They're not going to pursue the death penalty. He'll just have a life sentence, as I understand it. And if other people, if I'm misinformed or if I didn't read it correctly, folks can set me straight. Or I won't say the metaphor. People can correct me as well. Other folks that we have not heard from, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I thought your report was fascinating. I was just thinking as you were talking about it. I would say that the white female would have been a caution with the, even with the non-white child. And as long as the child wasn't doing something that can harm his or herself, I'm in that rocking chair and I see them. How far was the child from you when you first noticed the child?
Maybe 15 yards, 15 meters.
Oh, I would have went in the house and got some Kool-Aid or lemonade. I would have went in the house. Mainly because if I prior, I'm not in your position, so it's kind of like easy for me to say it perhaps, but if I had known ahead of time that that child was cared, quote unquote, cared for by a white person, I would keep distance, And I'm even like that with non-white black people with these silly holidays, like Halloween, when people come up to your door. They could be as cute as they want to be, you know, but I am not with the Halloween, that type of thing. And I just don't answer the door. Just don't answer the door from that standpoint, because I'm not going to participate in that, and I'm not going to go along with it because I'm not even for it, even with our children involved into it. But moving on but I have been caught off guard also. I feel you when you were talking about it. I've been caught off guard many a times. This week, two things. I don't think you reported it down here in Broward County, which is just adjacent north of Dade County, where I'm located at, in a public high school. There was two white females who decided to play a joke on their quote unquote non-white black female friend with the idea in mind of inviting her to the prom. I'll just read the report. Two white girls suspended for displaying a sign asking a black student to the prom. The sign said, "You may be picking cotton, but we're picking you to go to the prom with us." It went viral. Which is kind of like, it's not unusual for white people to be racist. And also what we have studied from a scientific standpoint on the cows is that white people automatically go to the mode of trying to say, well, okay, the situation was, it was a distasteful joke, but we didn't really mean it. It's not based on racism, blah, 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 you know, that sort of thing. But that was something that was reported in the news down here. Otherwise, something real constructive. I was at a football clinic. I attended a football clinic this morning at the University of Miami, and you have to register, and it is a cost. But I was assuming that it didn't require any cash, because I don't carry around cash a whole lot. I make the joke that if somebody robs me, they're only going to get practice because I don't carry cash with me. So I asked about whether or not it's cash, and they said yes. And the only thing I had was the debit card. But right behind me was a black male who said, "I got it." You know, as simple as that. You know, and young, tall black male. And so we started a conversation. And the same way I talk on the cows, just about for 9 times out of 10, I speak the same way. In terms of if there's something, and most, a lot of things are racially involved, I've used the term non-white, and it must have raised a thought in his mind. And he asked me, do you know anything about the cows, the cows program? And come to find out, the person is a listener to the cows program. I mean, very, you talking about ironic, you know, as far as that concerned. So your program, the program is really spreading pretty good. And me and the young fellow, we had a real good conversation, and I'm going to start corresponding with him via the phone and whatnot. You know, since we met in that unexpected way. But that's it. Thank you.
That is hilarious. That is hilarious. Just words are very important. Non-white does. That is one of the words that I pay attention to. I'm very sensitive to when I hear, because Most people that I'm around do not use that word when discussing issues dealing with racism, but that is hilarious. And there are other people in, I think Florida has always been an area that has a lot of cows listeners. There are people in Toronto. If you want to try to see if you can have contact with people that might listen to the cows in your area, just send me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and just put where your area is in the world, London contact, Toronto contact, and I will just forward the emails along. I think we had people in Houston and quite a few other locations. Florida has always got a lot of people, California, Texas, London, other people that we have not heard from. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Folks are spectating again. Wonderful, with a hand up. That's see any folks that we have missed. Everyone who has a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I just wanted to point out very briefly that I think it was. Because I know you mentioned about metaphors. I heard, I think it was about the black male victim who was, I believe, assaulted. And he took some damage to his jaw and to his teeth, I believe. And I don't know if that was an attorney. Mentioned something about Lady Justice going to serve shots of justice and it won't be any chaser. Like, I've never heard nothing like that before. And the person said it like, you know, that's how they normally talk. And the second thing I heard said was, I believe the guy was calling up to the show of the person that does the radio broadcast. And I believe that was Canada. So the guy, he made the phrase saying that, he said, I'm not a visual minority. You know, like I was kind of confused by that. So I don't know if anybody noticed that. Did you kind of pick up on that when you heard him say that, Gus? Is that what he mentioned about a visual minority?
I did. I do recall him saying that explicitly. And I also, that to me sounded like race soldier talk. And I'll be specific, like when white people deliberately try to avoid just saying that I'm a white person, I'm someone you should suspect of being a racist, they'll try and give you some sort of vague or ambiguous, deceptive language like that. I'm not a visual minority, whatever that means.
That sounds like some more codified terminology that they could be using maybe in the future sometime. And I would definitely suggest that non-white people be listening very keenly about that. And the last that I wanted to mention was, I think it was the Dave Chappelle segment. I don't know if that Rebecca person, I don't know if that was a white woman. Was that a white woman, Gus?
I think she's non-white.
Or was that a non-white? Okay, so she's non-white. I'm noticing that trend that black people are being basically made the example or being shown to be what they call homophobic, especially with I think it was the Oscars or whatever, with the Moonlight winning the best picture, I believe. And it's interesting how that continues to be put in the media like that. So that was another thing I found interesting. And those were the only three things that I had to make mention about. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey. Sorry about the speaker. I'll be brief. I'm just going to mention one thing. Follow-up on the Derek Stafford conviction. We all remember him. We don't need to go over the case. But if you remember, I said he was facing up to 60 years in prison. Well, he got 55 years out of those 60 for killing that little white boy and wounding his criminal white dad. Complete 40 on the manslaughter charge. 15 out of 20 on attempted manslaughter. And as I pointed out, Alton Sterling's white killers, they're still being investigated. Just remember that when you look at how this black cop from start to finish was done in 16 months. That's all I have to say.
White lives matter. Did other folks have commentary that we have not heard from?
Have you heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening to Gusta Host, to all the callers and listeners. Just want to say, the story about the guy in the store whose leg was turned around, and I saw that. Somebody had posted on Facebook, and I saw that. And I remember at first when I was looking at the picture, they kept saying something. I'm like, well, what am I looking at? Then when I looked at his feet, I thought, I was like, oh my God. And here's the thing, too, like somebody says, because if you're in the store, you know, because this was part of the situation with the Asian guy kicked that girl in the hair store. It's like, you know, when you're in the store, you can't be accused of well, we know black people, we can be, but you know, the thing is supposed to be, you can't be accused of shoplifting. It isn't until you either go out, you touch the door, you're going to have to do it. And I used to be a security guard a long time ago, so I know. And I mean, we're just seeing some horrendous things. And I guess my question though, is that store in the United States or was that store in Canada?
Canada.
Oh, okay. And so just from listening to the man who, you know, was the, I guess, host on the clip was like saying, you know, this store just, I mean, it's their record. You know, this is what they do to black people who come in their store, profile and all that. And, you know, this guy has been charged, I think it's like 4 charges. And, you know, I just shook my head. And his, and you know, kind of like the guy said, that leg was turned around. And chances are he's going to suffer, you know, pain and stuff for the rest of his life as a result of that. The bar in South Carolina, I was just looking at something on Twitter. So the owner of the bar has been arrested for that attack. His name is Daniel, as I was about Daniel Hostall. His name is Daniel Halsey, H-A-L-S-E-Y. And I can't think of his last name. So that's his first name and his middle name. And he's the owner of the bar. And they say that the bar is known to be racist. And from something I read on Twitter, it was, I think, black students can't go to the bar because you have to have, I guess, the University of South Carolina ID to get into the bar. So, you know, we could ask the question, it's like, well, what were you doing down there? All I know is, I'll say this, is when I first saw this story, because I saw it posted on Facebook too, all I could think of is when you sign off at the air, you say sobriety is like in the best interest. And all I could think of reading that story is just like, man, Gus Renegade, if he did not call that right, you're down here at this bar. You don't even do, from what I understand, he didn't know this man and the man didn't know him. Walk up, put him in a chokehold. And all I could think too, as I read that story, I said, because, you know, it's sad to say, but today, because we don't know our story in this country, or we don't know, because basically, you know, we talk about black history, but, you know, black history is American history. It wouldn't be no American history if it wasn't for black people. But we don't know, you know, the things I tell people sometimes. I say, you don't realize that one time if white people walking on the sidewalk and black people walking on the sidewalk, the black person had to get off the sidewalk. We just don't know the things. You know, white people always want to put their hands on us. You know, we listen to workplace racism. You always hear that. I mean, I'm still astounded by that, because I'm just like, what is the issue here? Why are these white women touching these black women on in their bodies and stuff? But, you know, as I read the story about what the guy did and I saw the video, it's like they always touch, you know, want to touch us, do things to us. I saw that video. He choked that guy, choked him out, threw him on the ground like he was throwing a piece of paper away, you know. And, I mean, it was just like, wow. And, you know, the question, I'm like, okay, well, where are your friends? Where are you down at? You got any friends that are supposed to be helping? Everybody standing around. And the video I saw was taken by some white guy because you could hear the white guy talking, watch, his hands are going to drop. He was basically like explaining what was going to happen. I mean, you know, and I just shook my head. So they do have someone now who has been arrested for that. And I don't know. I guess, you know, I'll just say this. Things are just going backwards real fast in regards to dealing with black people. Just like the caller before me said, you know, a police officer, it took them, what, less than 15 months, you know, for a police officer who killed a boy. I don't know the story. I don't know what the father was doing, but killed this boy, and now he gets like a 50-year sentence. And remember, there's another police officer that was also arrested, so his trial's going to come up. And, you know, the stuff up there in New York with Garner, I think it was Garner, it's a black female who was a sergeant. The last I read, and this was the end of last year, that they were bringing charges against her. No charges against the police officer, Pantaleo, or whatever his name is. They were bringing charges against her and possibility that she could lose, you know, her badge and all that go with that. And I'll just say this, and I, there was another video, I don't know, maybe I find it, I can send it to you, of some people in a restaurant, white woman standing in the restaurant, standing in the door, just going crazy. Get out of my country. Get out of my country. I hate you. And nobody does anything. I think the manager or I guess a worker in the restaurant comes up and stands, because they're, whoever was filming this, there were some black people sitting at a table. And the worker or the manager stands between the woman and, you know, she's just standing up there hollering. And, you know, it didn't seem like nobody called the police. They, you know, you're the ugliest MF, you know, get out of my country. And, you know, I just sit there and I'm like, this is Trump's America. This is where we at now. And I don't know, you guys. I don't know. I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you for taking my call. I'll mute myself.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Good evening to Gus, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Jay out of New York. Just giving a call. Great clips. Wanted to follow up on a couple of them in reference to the non-white male that was terrorized and choked out. This seems to be becoming a pattern just of all the activity that's happening. And one thing that I'm seeing in my area, I am a part of a martial arts studio. A lot of the, I guess I would call them the white racist in the area are not only training themselves, but they have their young junior race soldiers in training as well. And intense. I mean, really making sure that, you know, their children are spending a lot of hours. And the unfortunate part is I do not see a lot of that same training going on with the non-whites. And I think that's kind of a lot of the activity that's going on with these racist soldiers feeling at ease in terms of putting their hands on non-whites, because you know, they're actually going through training starting at like 3-4 years old at some of the classes that I'm seeing. So I would definitely alert individuals. If you're an attempted parent, do your best to get your children trained up about their surroundings, making sure that they're not kind of aloof when they're around a lot of these little junior race terrorists. Just to make sure that they're protecting themselves, as I try and do with my my little ones. But yes, there's a lot of training going on that at least I'm seeing from the classes. And like I said, the ratios are definitely now in our favor. So that's kind of what I wanted to mention on that. The situation with the non-white male that also got terrorized in the store. I'm not sure if you saw this, Gus, or the callers and listeners in reference to, there was a white female that was being detained by a non-white security officer, and the white female shoplifter actually, as the non-white security officer was holding her to wait for the cops to come, I mean, she's assaulting him, beating him, cursing at him. And the crazy thing is, the white shoppers that would usually be the superheroes and kind of coming to save the day if it was kind of a non-white person that was in the situation, they were there trying to almost come to her defense. One racist lady actually came in and actually tried to separate the security officer from the race soldier female that was a shoplifter, until he had to continually say over and over and over in the video that I'm a security officer, almost knowing that the people were probably going to attack him if he didn't continue saying he's a security officer and he's detaining her because she's a shoplifter. But it was amazing to see. If you hadn't seen it already, I think it's kind of gone viral now. But just as Neely Fuller says, no matter what job we have, white supremacy is the number one religion out there. So it was just kind of point proven to our non-power in this system, no matter what position we hold. The last situation I wanted to touch on is the clip that spoke about, and I forget the gentleman's name. I guess he was a prison mate with Mandela, the Indian gentleman. I had a conversation with a Trinidadian the other day, who's a store owner, and he is Trinidadian, but like a few individuals in Trinidad of Indian descent. He was explaining to me he was able to get a loan, and this kind of speaks to the, I'm not sure if it's the different privileges that were given to this gentleman in that prison situation that this Indian gentleman was telling me about, or this Trinidadian gentleman was telling me about his loan. He stated that the individual that got him the loan, as he was in the loan meeting, kind of signing all the papers, the racist, I guess you would kind of call him Jewish, loan officer, white male, said to him, oh, you know, your people are from India. And the gentleman corrected him and said, no, you know, we're from Trinidad. And the individual that got him to the loan officer to get the loan nudged him, kicked him under the table, almost to go along with him being Indian. Because as he started talking about his Trinidadian background, the individual kind of had like a skirmish look on his face, he told me. And he realized, if he didn't kind of go along with it, things would have probably changed a little bit. So it was interesting for me to kind of hear the clip. And then, I mean, I literally just heard the story last night as he was telling me about him getting this major loan to get his store opened up. And then it kind of adds up now as I'm seeing all these gasoline stations, hotels, and everything that's kind of happening in the New York, New Jersey area about all these Indians kind of getting these major loans to kind of open up all these shops. But racism, white supremacy kind of working at its best. But, you know, the clip kind of answered a lot of pieces to me. But just wanted to kind of share great clips, like I said, and I'll kind of mute my line. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Other folks we have not heard from. I'm seeing other hands.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Good evening, guys. Good evening to all the callers. Thomas Smith in New York. To what the guy just said, you know, unfortunately, some of these people come over and they have certain trade agreements that allow them to be put in certain credit categories to be able to come here and get loans. But it's in response to certain things that white people are doing in their country, raping and pillaging their countries, and you know, they get a little bit of incentives when they come here. A lot of Arabs get that as well. They can go and come right here and open up a convenience store, a gas station with no problem. As for the clips, Gus, you should ask the white lady, next time you see her, if you feel she's comfortable. I would say, would she have felt comfortable if her kid was not mixed race, if she jumped on your lap, if he was an all-white kid, if she would have felt comfortable with that, just to see what response she would have. I'm pretty sure she'll give you the, oh, my God, no, not. But I'm just curious if she'll be honest. As for the clips on the slave quarters, I don't think that I would agree with that. Rebuilding slave quarters, for what? I mean, who's it going to be rebuilt for? I just don't see the significance in that unless it's to, further terrorize black people by showing them that and put them in that element or further instill the, racist propaganda amongst white people. Look, this was the slave quarters. Look. I mean, I can't see us going to that slave quarters and feeling anything other than an emotion of, trauma, and the white people going in feeling nothing more than the emotion of dominance. So I just don't get the point of that. I think he used great sequencing with the Kaepernick story and then followed up with Dave Chappelle, sort of Kaepernick going against the grain. Dave Chappelle, the results of what happened when you go against the grain. And
metaphor.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I apologize. When you stand up, when you take a stance in the system, Kaepernick, by taking the knee in response to the national anthem, and Chappelle for not going along with the way they wanted, white people wanted to make the show, and from the interviews I see, make black people look bad. Whereas he was doing it in a comical way, they wanted to really, make us look bad. It wasn't funny. And he decided to walk away, which was, going against what the system, what is expected for black people to do. So I thought that was great sequencing because they, even though they're taking two different stances, this is the results of what happens when you take a stance against the system in any way. I had something else to add. It was more along the lines of as I say, working in the hospital, everything is racist as far as I'm concerned. I'm very liberal with how I interpret racism. So just have a hospital story if time prevails going further. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
For sure, Thomas in New York. Before I nab other folks, a person wrote in, they wanted to share this. I tabbed it as workplace racism, although this is not workplace racism. So I'll just share now. And then if people want to dial in, I'll give the number once I'm done. So the person said, last week while walking my dog where I live in Delaware, I was literally stalked by a white couple who approached me in an intimidating manner about cleaning up my dog's droppings. They watched me walk my dog for about 2 minutes and drove around a roundabout in my community to circle back to me to ask me if I was going to clean it up. I responded by saying, let me worry about that. And they responded by saying, well, are you going to clean it up? I then responded by saying, it looks like you are looking for trouble, so I suggest you just drive off. After I said this, the woman yelled, we live in this neighborhood now. Expletives coming up. I'm not taking them out because this is, he has it in quotes that this race soldier said this to him. So, cover your, if you got children, expletive coming up. So they yell at him, we live in this neighborhood, you fucking nigger. I responded by saying, what did you just call me? And quickly after this, I told her that she was looking for trouble. I got their license plate number as they drove off, and I immediately called the police. When the police arrived, to my surprise, they advised that people around here are still getting used to the community integrating. I proceeded with filing a report, giving them the plate number and getting a report number. The next day, they questioned the woman who did, in fact, live in my neighborhood, and she openly admitted she called me a nigger. The police asked me if I wanted to press charges, and I said yes. Then, a couple of days later, the courts called me and asked if I would like to mediate, and I said no. She is now facing charges of harassment. I told myself, I will not let this go, and I will not negotiate. I believe we are in a day and age where I feel black people are not in a position to negotiate with white people who are expecting us to back down when we are confronted with it. Now, this person used the term ignorance. I don't know if this is someone who has not been listening to the Cows very long, or if they just reject some of the core tenets in terms of my views on racism, white supremacy with this program. They said expecting black people to back down when we are confronted with white people's ignorance. What is described in this letter categorically, definitively, as sure as anything that I'm sure of in the universe, this is not the behavior of someone who is ignorant. This is the behavior of someone who is an expert in terrorizing niggers. That's what it sounds like to me. And I think we will make better decisions just based on logic. Strive for accuracy. That's one thing that we can do that works against racist man, racist woman. I think that helps racism when we think that white people are ignorant, that they're stupid. You do not want, when you have a hostile opponent, the last thing that you want to do is think that this person is dumb when they are methodical, calculating, and lethal. That is a major point, maybe one of the main primary points of emphasis on this program. So this is not ignorant. I'm glad that you filed the report. That is a phenomenal illustration of black self-respect. Let us know how things proceed with the trial. And I think that is a tremendous strategy. I'm not going to negotiate if I have been mistreated. We're not going to settle and forgive. We are not doing that at all. I was violated and I want to press charges, maximum charges that can be pressed. And let's get that hopping right now. Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary. The number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks we haven't heard from. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, is that you guys? Oh, cool. Thank you. Oh, the clips. I wanted to comment on the clip with the guy. I guess he had a juvenile record, and they sealed it, and then they unsealed it. I had a juvenile record, and my aunt made me seal it. It was nothing. It just trespassing. As a little kid. But I noticed how when it comes to us, just like with Bill Cosby, they just unseal whatever they want to do. They'll tell us they're doing one thing, but in actuality, it really doesn't pertain to us. That's just something that they say. And anytime they want to open anything, close anything, that's what they do. And we dare not say anything about it. The loss prevention clip, that was terrible that they tackled him like that, but they always do that. They'll fight. I mean, you shouldn't steal, because I when I listen to Neely Fuller's program, he'll say, even for today, don't steal because they're watching us. So for them, that's terrible that they have to steal, but you shouldn't have to take that kind of force
with anyone, but they do. And I did see the clip of the Caucasian lady that got arrested. Oh, she got detained by the loss prevention, I mean, the security guy or whomever. And those white women were on his, oh, they were not playing games. They, hey, leave her alone. Let her go. Don't watch your mouth, young man. And they were just really putting him in his place, letting him know. It was crazy. So it is a difference with us when we steal and when they steal. Another clip that I remember was, oh, that Dave Chappelle clip. Now, I didn't know people were offended by him and the things that he says, but I saw both of those Netflix clips. I didn't like them. I don't know who that guy is. I don't know who that is, that guy, Dave Chappelle. I don't know who that is. I love Dave Chappelle. I don't know who that guy is, so it really weirds me out. But I hope they don't try to make a big deal out of him and saying negative things about him. So we'll see. I don't know what's going on with that. And then I do remember another clip. I guess it was some kind of slave quarter. And the lady was saying something about a plantation, maybe whatever the field was, it just was like a plantation. It reminded her of her ancestors. And she said when she goes home, she's just grateful that she has a roof over her head and a bed to lay on. So maybe I should look at a lot of things like that, because they went through a little more. Even though we go through a lot of stuff, there it was much harder for them in those days. So I think that's all I want to comment on. And thank you for taking my call. And I really appreciate the program. There's times that I can't speak because I'm usually driving, like right now, or doing things. But I do keep up, and I do listen to every single program. And thank you again, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Black mom in the Bay Area. This is the mother of the young caller who writes in, dials in to share his views, doing great work, sharing counter-racist information, logic with her child. I think, I don't have my word guide, like I can't put my hand on it where I'm sitting, but I think Mr. Fuller does suggest in the word guide that we try to avoid thinking or saying things could be worse, and saying that is kind of it's the type of logic that racists would want victims. That's the way that they would want victims to think, that things could always be worse in a situation where things are incorrect, that you shouldn't be thinking, well, things are incorrect now, we're being mistreated now, or whatever we're being subjected to, but it could be worse. He has more detail than I'm giving currently, but I do think that is in the word guide. I'll make an effort to look again to confirm. Other folks we have not heard from at all.
Can I be heard? Go ahead. I'll go after you.
Wonderful.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. You could speak up. That would be great.
I'm sorry. Thank you for taking my call. And hello to everyone. I actually didn't get a chance to listen to the clips, but I just listened to the previous caller just talk about the Dave Chappelle and how people weren't really happy about what he said. I actually just recently watched the new Stand Up on Netflix, and I was basically throughout the whole stand up just looking at the white people's faces, and you can just definitely kind of tell the disgust that they had with the things that he was saying about Bill Cosby. So I just thought that was actually one of the more funny parts of the stand up, and it was just basically mainly all white people in the audience. And then, of course, when he was talking about just the different police shootings and how he was saying that people are starting to get more normal or starting to become more familiar with someone being shot or someone being murdered by the police, you could definitely tell just how uncomfortable they were. I had a situation, and also I just started thinking about the situation just based on what Gus was talking about, the person who wrote in about the dog droppings.
So I visit my cousin, and my cousin actually lived off of a very busy street. In the past, I would park on the busy street, and my car would get hit. It basically just, like, someone would take off my side view mirror. So I decided to park a little bit down the road from her house off of a side street that really doesn't get that much traffic. Well, I was, and I've been doing this for probably over a year now, and my car hasn't gotten hit. So I was walking out one night, and it was kind of late. It was almost 10 o'clock. I was headed home, and this white man who lives across the street from where I was parking my car, he, I don't know if he was waiting on me to come out. It kind of made me feel like he was waiting, because just out of nowhere, he had said, well, can you not park there? Because apparently I was parking adjacent to his driveway entrance, and this is a public street, so and there's no signs. I can basically park wherever, but very abrasive, and he was like, you know, well, can you park somewhere else? Can you scoot up? Because I can't get out of my driveway, which is a lie. You can basically have three cars, like a car on either side of the street parked, and then another car traveling down the street. So there would be no reason for him to basically ask this. And I didn't know what to say, and all I said was all right, and I just hurried up and got in my car. But those people, there's a man and a woman, I'm assuming, and they've always been definitely very rude, especially when it comes to black people. My cousin has told me some stories about them having issues with her just waiting in front of their house for her son to get off the bus. So I'm not quite sure how to handle the situation, because I feel like it was more of a command rather than, you know, just a request. Because if the man decides to get angry and hit my car intentionally, I actually am not going to be able to hear it, since I'm not that close to where I'm actually parking. I have to get out my car, and I walk probably about five houses down. So I don't know if maybe anyone has any suggestions. I know it's definitely not, you know, that important, but it definitely, you know, put me off guard, and I didn't want to necessarily confront the man because it was late and I literally didn't even notice him, even though I, you know, I try to stay pretty alert. But that's all I had, and thank you for allowing me to share.
Did you have, I don't know, like a weapon of some sort? I just asked because I think all of us, with the number of different incidents that people have said, is that something that you had on you at the time, or is that something that you would consider given, you know, him confronting you, and you said it was kind of late when this happened?
I have been thinking about getting, like, you know, the tactical pen, and I actually live in Ohio, so I have definitely been pondering getting a firearm. So, but I'm like, if that's in my car, then, you know, if I can't get to my car quick enough, but I'm definitely just considering what happened, because I don't plan on not, like, staying away from my cousin's house. So I was definitely planning on doing something.
Really important for all of us to consider. And like you said, it could be a tactical pen. It can be a number of things that you can have, but just really important. And just being aware of our surroundings at all times. White people are extremely dangerous, and in both from what you just shared with the caller wrote in, the incident in South Carolina where the black male was literally choked almost to death from behind, just, and so many of these incidents, they happen. These are things, as I state consistently, these are things that happen in 60 seconds. You didn't know the person. You've never seen this person before. You all don't have some sort of vendetta with just a race. Oh, there's a nigga. Let's go get him. 60 seconds and, you know, you're being choked out. Might die. Who knows what could happen? So just really take it seriously. White people are dangerous. Never minimize that. Pay attention to your feelings. If you think there's something awry, take that seriously and really, you know, consider self-defense for you and your children, given what the caller talked about earlier. Folks have suggestions as well, because I think you did say you were open to feedback, right, ma'am?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. For sure. If we'll get people that have not shared as we go. So if you want to add your suggestions, if you have any, for how to deal with the situation, we can get that. And then after everybody's got one turn, if folks want to, that have already spoken, if they want to give a suggestion, we'll make time for that also. Folks, we have not heard from any other people. I think, Roz, you should be there.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Gus. Greetings to you, to the other callers and the listeners. I'm sorry that the previous caller is going through something like that. I think the tactical pen is a brilliant idea. There's quite a few videos on YouTube that show you how to use it and the techniques of using it and how to triage your blows, because you can, you know, really, really hurt somebody, or you can actually kill them with it if you have to defend your life to that point. So the videos would be really helpful, because you don't have to be big to take down somebody that's very big. Also, I would suggest, too, a tactical flashlight. They have them. They're very small. They're made out of military-grade aluminum, and they have nubs on the flashlight portion that can be used for self-defense. They can also be used as a glass brick, and they would be used very similar to a tactical pen, and they can be serious as well. So I would definitely suggest that. If it's possible, I don't know how often you end up having to park near him, near his driveway, simply because, you know, I guess I'm not aware of how his street is as far as just how people park during weekdays, weekends, whatever the case may be. If you can avoid parking in that area at all, that would be good, so you don't have that sort of contact. Outside of that context, I would just say just be very alert. There's a good book called Spy Secrets That Can Save Your Life. It's written by an ex-CIA agent. And in the book, he gives a lot of great tips on how to remain aware, especially at night or just when traveling, how to be aware of if you're being followed or being stalked in any way. Also, self-defense techniques. He's the person that from that book that I learned about a tactical pen from. And it's a really, really good book as far as just giving you battlefield awareness. And also the use of a tactical flashlight can help you at night, so that you can see better, and you can also blind an opponent with it temporarily, which can allow you to either escape or to put them down as quickly as possible without them having much defense because they're temporarily blinded. That would be my suggestions, and I wish you the best as well. And I was just going to say, Gus, in reference to what you were saying with Eric Garner, what really annoys me about the Eric Garner discussion is that people keep saying that he was killed after being searched for illegal cigarettes, and he was never caught with any illegal cigarettes on that search. Like, he wasn't guilty of anything when that happened. And the other part of it was that his reaction was really to being cavity searched twice in public on the streets of New York. And he I think they were attempting to cavity search him again, or at least that was what he thought, that made him react in the manner that they used as a means to kill him. So I just think that that's just annoying sometimes when I hear the discussion on Eric Garner, that those things aren't made clear. Also, about the Dave Chappelle clip, I found it telling that everybody's going off about this so-called offense against transgender people, and I don't think that transgender people, gay people, anyone should be abused in any way, shape, or form. But, I mean, comedians have been telling jokes about homosexual people for as long as jokes have been told, and all of a sudden now it's this whole politically correct thing, and this whole means of trying to play up the whole transgender movement as if their struggle is anything on par with Black people's struggle in this country. Like, they don't make up a sizable population in the country. They don't get abused nearly as much as regular heterosexual Black males and females at all. There's no comparison there. But yet the way this issue is being discussed in public, you would think it was like this major epidemic, and that that there was something going on where they were in danger due to the severe violence against them. And it's just nauseating to keep hearing this ad infinitum, this false premise that's being propagated about this whole transgender movement. The officer that made the racist video, that clip about the officer that made the racist video, to me, it just kind of indicates how racism is in the DNA of the law enforcement division of the United States, simply because they had said at one point the video did not indicate racial bias as far as the officer's racial bias. I believe it might have been his superiors in the police force that said that. But I don't understand how that did not indicate racism when he's using explicit terms that are used to demean Black people, like nigger and thug, but yet it's not considered racist or any sort of race-based assault on black people. So white people interpret the law however they feel like it, and when they come together to protect one another, the results are the nonsense that we heard in that clip. Mr. Ahmed Katrada, the clip about him, I just want to say respect to him for his work against apartheid in South Africa, and him specifically working with black South Africans. I find that very interesting because him being of Indian descent and being classified as black, the clip said that he was classified as black, and I found that to be very interesting, simply because the caste system in India is so profoundly racist. And their whole way of looking at dark-skinned Indians as well as dark-skinned black people. I don't know what he looked like, if he was a dark-skinned Indian or if they just said called him black as far as their system due to the fact that he aligns himself with black Africans. But it's just interesting because the term Indian actually means black. That prefix IND is also the same prefix that's in the word ink, which also indicates black. Indigo, which indicates the term blue-black, which is where the term blue-black comes from. So it's just very interesting that he was termed as black when the term Indian itself actually means black. And what I like about him is that he's everything that Gandhi was not, because Gandhi was a virulent racist who did not like black people and made it abundantly clear that he did. And he also was known to have killed quite a few black people when he was in the military in South Africa. So what I like about Mr. Katrada more than anything else was that he was about justice. He aligns himself with the most abused people in South Africa and worked hard towards that end. So maximum respect to him. And the medical apartheid clip finally was just incredible. Working in the healthcare industry, I can just say that white people are the biggest vectors of some of the most virulent diseases ever known to man. And I see it every day working in the medical field. And it's something to behold when they're experimenting on us and passing on their illnesses to us, to experiment on us and see how these diseases progress amongst black people. And they're just disgusting. Like, to lay with them, to eat from them, to touch them, it's just not a good thing. It's a very dangerous thing for us as people. And I hope that we start to learn from at least that clip and just from the studies that we've done how dangerous white people are. Thank you very much, and I'll meet my mind.
Other folks that we have not heard from, if you're on the line, you have a hand up, you have a commentary you want to share, something, if you want to give a response on how to deal with the parking incident with the suspected race soldier, go ahead and get a hand up. We have about 30 minutes left. Anybody that has a hand up that we have not heard from at all? We got everybody, nobody with us who has a hand up that we have missed completely. Awesome. Okay. Got everybody. Folks that have additional commentary they would like to share, if any of the folks that already spoke, if you want to give a suggestion on how to deal with the parking situation, that would be good as well. I know a different victim of racism, they had a similar incident with parking. Parking is really bad in the Seattle area, so they tell me, where this white woman came out and was being really hostile about the parking situation. They both lived in the neighborhood, and he just brought up, you know, hey, there is no one has legal right to this space. And you know, I'm in the neighborhood, I think, tried to be very amicable about it. No one has legal right to the space. I understand that this is close to your house and you like parking here, and I don't want any conflict or what have you, and I'm agreeable with, you know, allowing you to have the space in general. But legally, no one, you know, has ownership, proprietary ownership of this spot. Anyone can park here. And that did a lot to shift the conversation. I know you were saying, too, about worrying about, you know, if he decides to hit your vehicle and that sort of thing. That's definitely important to keep that in mind as well when making a decision. Other folks have suggestions on that or other comments they want to share? Spectating. suggestions. I think that is serious, the parking situation. I was certainly hopeful if folks, you know, had some thoughts on that. I know Thomas in New York hopefully will, if you have a free moment, I guess, where it's quiet, to share a thought before things conclude. Your other commentary, I meant. Well, folks are...
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was just, just a pretty sad story. And, you know, based off of the conditioning that we're in due to the system of racism, white supremacy, and just watching different interactions, a very young child came into the hospital, you know, being shot, wounded with a gunshot, 13 years old, just the way the cops talk about it, and however, they liked his mom, very nice lady, and she saw the kid's side and came to find out that this wasn't his first time being shot, you know, he's 13, which is, you know, really sad. And it's, you know, just the way the cops are talking, pretty much like, she's such a nice lady, she just can't control her kids and, you know, this, that, and the other, you know. So just the sad part of the whole thing is the day after, I'm talking to a security guard, and happens to be someone who I grew up with. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, some people, and someone's trying to get upstairs, and, you know, they don't have access. So you come to find out that this was this young guy's brother, and he had to be on the list, you know, because of the nature of the crime, you know, that got the kid there. You know, they have to make sure everyone's being screened. And when I came in the day after that, that young brother was killed. So the mother's upstairs at the bedside of one son, and to find out her 16-year-old son was, you know, downstairs. You know, it was just like a sad situation, and just to see how the cops interact with it. You know, just so I'm very sad. But also to speak to the younger black kids, and you always talk about, you know, especially on this show, and I slipped up earlier with using a metaphor. And you always say, you know, how metaphors, you know, wouldn't be best to use. And when I speak to the young kids, and they mention shootings, and I guess, you know, my generation, we did the same thing, but it's just these simple metaphors, you know, simple one-syllable metaphors, like, you know, you got smoked or wet or eared or whacked or clipped or popped. You know, it just makes it sound so simple. And I just wish we would use murdered, you know, you know, it just sounds a lot more harsh. It gives a lot more emphasis to what's being done and what we're doing to each other as a result of the, you know, conditioning of being, you know, under the system of racism and white supremacy. And, you know, that was pretty much my story. You know, that really saddened me, you know, to see that lady, you know, already in a sad condition, a very nice lady, and, you know, to go downstairs and her other son is, you know, it was just very emotionally, you know, draining for me. Absolutely. And it's all due to the system. You know, it's not our fault, but it's not our fault. It's our reaction to this system.
Wow. That is horrendous. Man, that is... And that is what the system of racism, white supremacy is designed to produce, where black people, non-white people in total, but especially black people, you're not able to be effective parents. That's why Mr. Fuller, where he says, you know, attempted parent, attempted mother, attempted father. That's why he uses those terms specifically in the word guide and, you know, in his talks and what have you. And then just having, you know, all sorts of harm and violence happening to black people, even... especially black children. That is, by design, worldwide system of white supremacy. Other folks with us have commentary. Anyone who had a hand up, anything you wanted to get in before we wrap up?
Yes, sir.
Let's see. Is that the black mom in the Bay Area?
Yes, I am.
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to comment on the lady that was having the issue, the parking issue, and then wanting to get some form of protection. The parking issue, I probably wouldn't move my car. It depends on how I'm parked and where. I would probably check it out because I know a lot of people that are pretty particular about, oh, don't park in front of my house or don't park here or there for whatever reason. I guess it depends on how you ask me. Maybe I might move. I might not. I might, since we have technology, take a picture of my car just to make sure you don't hit mine and take a picture of yours. So if you do something to my car, I could always make a report or do something to counteract that. But I guess it's all, you just think it out and see the best way to work it without causing any unnecessary confrontation. And with their form of protection, I don't know what a retractor pin is. I think maybe somebody could tell me. But one of those electric stun guns sounds great. And you just keep it in your purse. They even have nice, cute ones like colors. They're neat. So a stun gun sounds cool. And you can just, that's great. So I would try one of those. And then if someone can tell me what a retractor pin is, that'll be nice because maybe I could get one of those if it's not a knife. Because I would rather just have a stun gun. That'll be neat. And, yeah, that's it. That's it.
It's Thank you. It's a tactical pin. Tactical pin with a T. And it is a pen like it writes, but it's made out of a very sturdy material, like military grade steel. It has a significant weight to it. If you pick it up, it's significantly heavier than a normal pen. And so then they have videos that show you how to use it. Like, I mean, you could probably stab a significant hole in someone or whatever you want to do. I mean, it's pretty, you could probably just drop it on someone's head and that alone, just the weight of it would hurt. But I mean, they have videos where they can show you how to use it effectively, but it's tactical pen.
Is that what Roz had, like on the BART or whatever? What was that, the subway or whatever, when the police was following them around? Is that something like that?
Yes,
or
that's
is that
what I had.
Him?
Yes,
oh, okay.
That's what I had.
Okay.
What happened was it had a long clip to it, and he said he thought it was a knife because the clip was so long. So when I took it out my pocket and I said, it's a pen. And then I popped the top off and I said, see, it writes, it's a pen. And he said, oh, no problem. And that was it when everything went down. And Gus is right. You do have ones that are made out of aircraft grade steel. And then you have other ones that are lighter that are made out of aircraft grade aluminum, but they're no less dangerous. And basically you can either use them to break glass if you're trapped in a building or in a car and it's on fire. Or you can use it to defend yourself. And it's just an incredibly effective tool you can take just about anywhere. And it'll protect you. And if you learn how to use it, you can save your life.
Well, I'll get one then. That sounds better. Oh, I'll get one. Thank you.
Anytime.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just want to say thank you for everyone for the suggestions. I did actually just look up the tactical pen and also the tactical flashlight. It's definitely something that I'm going to be getting very soon. There was one other thing that Thomas from New York made me think about, and I definitely want to thank him for all of his stories about the hospital because one of the things that I start to say to black people who I feel more comfortable speaking to is his story about the Wall of Heroes. And it just makes me think about medical apartheid. And the issue that I had recently was that I had to get my license renewed. And so if you, in the past, when I was much more confused, I thought that being an organ donor was something of like, you just would help out of it would be very helpful to people, I guess. So once I listened to the podcast of Medical Apartheid and I was doing a little bit more research myself, I decided that I no longer wanted to be an organ donor. So I decided to just wait until it was time for me to renew my license. When I went to renew my license, I said over and over again, take me off the list. Now the lady and the female was a non-white black female. She was very nice. I definitely don't blame her in any way, shape or form. She said in her system, it showed that I was no longer an organ donor. However, on my ID, it still said that. And so when I got my new ID, it still said it on the ID that I was an organ donor. And I felt like it's definitely something, it seems like it's systematic. So it, even if you say you don't want to donate your organs, especially with what Harriet Washington brought up in the book, it seems like it's just supposed to work in their favor. So I have no faith in that. If I were to get into an accident and I'm sure they will harvest my organs because it says it on the ID rather than going through some system saying or seeing that, oh, it just says it doesn't say it in the system. But I definitely want to thank everybody for their suggestions. That's all I had.
Ma'am, did you say you did not get to hear the clips at the beginning today?
Yeah, I actually missed them today.
Okay. You don't have to listen to all of them. You don't have to listen to any of them, really. But the last clip, I played the introduction to Medical Apartheid because they had a whole segment on South African talk radio. It was called Colonialism and Medicine. And it was Medical Apartheid. In fact, they mentioned Henrietta Lacks. They mentioned the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. They mentioned, they just didn't say Harriet Washington, but they went through all of the cases that, a lot of the cases that she talked about. It was fascinating, and it was right in line with racism and the healthcare industry, some of the things Thomas talked about as well. But it was the last clip in the news clips that I played today.
Well, thank you. I'll definitely, usually when I miss the clips, like other callers have said, I definitely don't. This is show, but I will make sure to listen to him. Thank you.
Good.
Can I be heard?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. I didn't hear fully the parking situation. It sounded like it wasn't the normal dispute over it, because I was just... it didn't sound like the normal dispute that normally takes place with parking. I got there first, that sort of thing like that. But I can see, you know, of using your phone by filming the episode and also getting the tag of the person. Probably wouldn't say anything to her directly. As I mentioned before, I'm not privy to the details on what took place, but it sounds like it's much more complicated than what the answer that I'm giving. I just wanted to report this last incident that took place this week, actually a couple of days ago, because of significance. It could have been another situation where a black person, in this case a black female, could have been shot to death by the police. Actually, she was being accused of a crime. In this case, she was in a plastic surgery facility. The news report reported that she had some sort of habit of going places and not paying. So it was some kind of fraud situation. Somehow the business called the police, and all of this was on camera. Very clear too, on camera. Of her getting into her automobile, attempting to leave the parking facility, and the police officers would appear to be two white males, had their guns drawn. The audio was very clear, and she just kept right on going.
just kept right on going. I'm pretty sure they're going to catch her because they have a past picture of her and her name and everything. But I was just saying to myself as I was looking at it on the news that she is quite fortunate that she's still alive, you know. And I think it may have something to do with the unfortunate legacy of a Trayvon Martin and whatnot. The white people say, well, you know, well, we're not gonna kill this nigga right here because I don't feel like having to do all the paperwork for killing her. That sort of thing, you know. Just a thought came to my mind, you know, from watching it on the news. But anyway, that's just something that I forgot to report on that I remember taking place on the news, I think the day before yesterday or yesterday. Thank you.
Gus, I wanted to know if I could ask the previous female caller a question.
Sure thing.
Okay, thank you. To that caller, I heard you say that even though you let them know in the Department of Motor Vehicles that you no longer wanted to be an organ donor, that they did not remove that X from the donor box. And I was wondering if there was any legal recourse to getting that corrected, simply because you don't want, and the thing that I'm thinking is, if you are in any sort of accident and your life is savable, but yet if they're neglectful, you'll pass away. They will let you die to get your organs because you have that box checked off. It's just happened so many times. Even with Oscar Grant, they purposefully did not treat his wound properly. He had an oxygen bubble that went into his bloodstream, and that's what facilitated him dying there on the platform because they didn't do the proper procedures on his chest with the wound. So you having that X on that donor card really puts your life at risk if you get into any sort of accident where your life is savable, but the potential for death is high, they're going to probably let you die so they can get your organs. And I've always told people that I've met throughout the years not to check that box because I said, once you check it, I believe because you're black, you're not going to be able to get rid of it. And this is what's happening with you, sadly, is like proof positive, like to never, if you're black, never, ever check off that donor box. But I'm thinking you should really look into something legal to get that removed, or even if you go back to change your ID and let them know explicitly, like, stop putting that X in that box. If you do it, I'm going to come back here and get a new ID until you get that X off of the box. And if you can also do like maybe a living will where you indicate that you do not want your organs donated whatsoever and things of that nature to try and at least legally protect yourself from being harvested. Because, I mean, the amount of money you can make off of a black body is about maybe, I think, $1.5 to $2 million for all the organs they can steal. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, and it's not just your organs. Every single part of your body comes off. They're going to send it to the colleges. I mean, they come and pick stuff up generally in the overnight shift. I wonder why. But, every part, I mean, your leg is probably going to go to some orthopedic school where they're going to teach kids something. I mean, so every part of your body, including your skin, this pill, I mean, every part goes to a part to get donated. And it's not just to an organ. I mean, this is just to a school where they're going to, you know, they probably have 30 students in the class, so they had to get 30 legs to let the kids do experiments on them, you know, or shouldn't say kids, I mean, young adults to do. The story you read, Gus, about the lady walking the dog, I think it was a lady. I was really thought that was great, you know, black self-respect to follow through and just to see what happened. So whoever that was, I hope they keep us updated. And also, your critique was great. White people are not ignorant at all. None of them from the youngest age to the oldest age are not ignorant about practicing racism. But the part that really got me, and which I consider, because my aunt has these, and I would probably thinks the person has these little things that they call dogs today. But they didn't even exist when I was a kid. Your dog was a dog, you know. And she's calling them droppings. I mean, you know, it's like something a mouse does. You know, it's like, it just sounded a little funny. I'm like, does she have a dog or a mouse, you know, or a rat, you know? But these little dogs, they probably just do droppings, I guess. But I'm just glad. I was just bringing that up because I would really like to hear what's going to happen. What's this judge and prosecutor going to do?
I hope we get the update. I will encourage them to let us know how the trial goes. Take good notes, and let us know what the result of everything is. I was going to say, I think someone had mentioned before black people having dogs in public, and my housemate, pregnant black mom, she has a little dog, a Yorkie. The kind of small, I think he's like 10 pounds, maybe 11. But generally, I always vote. If he goes out to take him in the store or what have you, because white people treat us way better with the dog present. Like someone had talked about that before. And I like knowingly, willingly do it because it is substantial. Like we were in the grocery store, and it was a white woman. She had a cart, Race Soldier. I moved out of the way, and I had the dog on a leash, and I moved both of us because the dog was kind of lagging, so I was kind of pulling him so he wouldn't, you know, get hit by her cart. And she says, I wouldn't dare hit the little fella. And she's, you know, all how people can get into it. And I'm even looking at that because I was just like, wow, like white people generally do not respond to me in that way. And at the time, I just cracked up laughing because it was like, I wouldn't dare hit him. Now, you, on the other hand, I would have no problem running over you any day of the week, 2 days on Sunday. But I would not hit this little guy. Look at him. Because that's exactly the way it felt for me. But yeah, it's totally different. Generally, I generally am treated much better with the dog. I'm surprised he had that sort of, and I think that might have been a black male. I'm not sure. Maybe they can clarify, but yeah, I'm surprised they had that sort of interaction because white people generally are much, much, much nicer. Racists are generally much more courteous with me when I have a canine.
Hey, Gus.
If it was a pit bull, Gus, do you think they'll still have that same courtesy, you know, a real dog, not one of these things they made up over the last 20, 30 years that people put in a pocketbook?
Absolutely not. I've been with a pit bull. I was telling my friend, like, because like I said, the Yorkie, he's like 10 pounds. I have been with a pit bull out in public before. In fact, I was with a female pit bull. We were in California. We were running Lake Chabot, for people who know Bay Area, California. We were running. So I had the pit bull and I have the dog, and I'm running and it's crowded. And the look of horror on the white people's face, just seeing a black male running with a pit bull, like, oh my gosh. Like, I cannot believe I got out without being maced, tackled, maybe even strangled. It was totally different experience with a pit bull.
Hey, Gus, you almost had me split my side just now with what you said, because I could imagine what you were saying. I've never been to California, but I've seen that in New York City, and the look of horror on white people's faces are priceless when those moments happen. Thankfully, you made it out of that situation safely. When we were discussing the whole organ theft thing, I remember that earlier today, a friend of mine sent me an ad for a South African organ harvesting company. And I think what it says is pretty telling. Do you mind if I read it? It's not that long at all.
Sure.
Okay. It says, it's a New Day Clinic is what it's called, the company. And it says, life is a gift, one that you deserve. So why languish in poor health when the poor could be used to help you live longer and prosper? Our buildings, doctors, and equipment are all top of the line. Our scrub-garbed professionals keep your care as their top priority. They only live
to serve. For a hassle-free experience, choose the right medical services. Choose New Day Clinic. About us, human organ transplantation. We offer unprecedented access to human organs and tissues, exchanging death for life. Transplantation has dramatically improved the lives of recipients and enabled them to be active, healthy members of society. Confidentiality. Our line of work is highly confidential. We believe that our ascertainment of organs is to rid the world of the worthless human beings that leech on our society's resources. Each body can supply 7 organs, each freshly extracted when required. They ensure that we give life to those who play a vital role in society. State-of-the-art facilities and world-class doctors. Dr. Anton Wright is New Day Clinic's lead transplant surgeon who specializes in kidney, liver, heart, and pancreas transplants and is co-director of the Life Exchange Research Program, LERP. Your health is worth it. On the average, 22 people die each day waiting for a transplant. There's no need to waste any more time sitting on a list. Contact us today and an organ will be sourced within 1 week. We have an unlimited supply. The price list excludes operation expenses and clinic stay. For a kidney, it's ₹3,545,000. For a liver, it's ₹2,069,400. For a heart, is ₹1,550,624. For the small intestine, is $33,600. For a pair of eyeballs, is $20,000. For a coronary artery, is $20,000. For a gallbladder, is $15,900. For a spleen, is $7,000. And for skin, is ₹140 per square centimeter. Contact us. Just wanted to let you hear that. And that's a real company. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to answer Roz's question really quick. I was actually going to see about first trying to get it changed because they also messed up my address on my ID. And then also, like you and Thomas have been mentioning, I think it might have been yourself, Roz, how I have been feeling like since I have had that donor, because it's actually like a little emblem. It's not necessarily an X. They changed it for whatever reason. But I have been feeling like, should I need help if they do see that? I'm in complete agreement with you that I don't think that I would get, you know, the help that I would need. So I'm definitely going to just try it first, just go back there, make it adamant again before I leave, make sure that the emblem is gone, and if not, then see about what else I can do. But I will definitely keep you posted. Thank you.
Any final comments before we wrap things up? Oh, I did want to make sure I get in. For any of the folks, if you are not following the book club, Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy. I have not read it. It's brand new. It just came out this year, 2017. It is phenomenal. If the rest of the book, we just started it yesterday, if the rest of the book is as good as the first 3 chapters, my top 10 might have to be rearranged. It is phenomenal and gives a lot of great information directly about racism, white supremacy. I would encourage folks to tune in to the book club for Coretta Scott King's My Life, My Love, My Legacy. And she was a co-author of the autobiography. Anybody have a final thought they wanted to get in before we conclude?
I want to second that. And I was telling my wife and kids earlier some of the stories from that book, just from the first session, just telling them about how her father's sawmill was burnt down, how her house was burnt down as a kid, and you know, how her father still persevered and started a convenience store. And I was telling them about, you know, how black people had to pay to go to school past the 6th grade, you know, just little tidbits from the book. And I think it is a very, very good read. And after what Roz just read, man, you know, I'm thinking about taking some body parts myself now. You know, that might be a new hustle going on. I might need to jump on it. Leave a body in there. I might have to. I'm just joking, of course, but that's a lot of money. Wow.
I guess the name of the company would be Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein. I agree with the book read. It sounds like it's going to be very interesting. I was surprised. I didn't hear any of the ladies in the last session. and looking forward to hear their comments and thoughts based on what we read also. I'm just thinking from the standpoint that Mrs. King is probably one of the, historically speaking, one of the most significant black females in the 20th century. And to hear another non-white black female comment on the reading would be, I think, an interesting part of the meeting next week. Thank you.
Hear, hear. Hopefully they'll join us starting next Friday. Again, it is phenomenal. Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, as told to Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds, acclaimed black journalist. With that, we will be back later in the week. If you have suggestions, questions, if you can't find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. I meant to get in as well. Reading is more important than watching television. That said, number one, I think I'm going to the Seattle Art Museum to see the Jacob Lawrence exhibition. I'm so excited. It's about to leave in a few weeks, so I think I'm going to try and get that done soon, and I will report back. I even thought of taking pictures so that I can make some comments and then I can post it on my blog. But I'm really excited to go check it out, and even to see how many black people are going to be at the SAM, because it's kind of pricey. I think it costs about $25 to go to be able to access the Jacob Lawrence exhibit. Black male painter. He did a lot of portraits of the black migration and things during the 20th century, but it's kind of pricey in my view. Anywho, I'll report back on that. The other thing, The Walking Dead, you don't need to watch the series at all. I'm just pointing this out based on my knowledge of the comic book and the television show. Last week they had a scene where a black female character, where they have her in bondage, her hands have been tied and what have you, and a white male, suspected race soldier, threatens her, and he says, I have a rope. That's what he says. He says, I have a rope. And he talks about knowing the utility of keeping a rope nearby for such occasions. And it reminded me of Dr. Martin Kevorkian when he was on the program and we talked about The Purge. And he said that was one of the most chilling moments in the film for him. The first Purge was when the white guy in the family, they have the black male, and he says, get a rope. That there is a long history. That is how white people solve problems with niggers. Get a rope. That's one. And then it goes from get a rope to I'm going to rape you. And the whole history of white people raping black people. Daniel Holdsclaw even. That's how it starts. That is a pattern even within The Walking Dead. The only reason you might miss this is for people who haven't followed the comic book. In the comic book, Michonne is raped. They do not include that in the TV show, but that is in the comic book. Very early on, she is raped by white people. That is a pattern just within the series itself. With that, we will conclude. We'll be back. Just check Black Talk Radio Network. You can check the Facebook page for the updates. That technology program should be coming this week. I'm so excited. But if you need anything clarified, again, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. And again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Being around whites and alcohol is extremely dangerous. Even being around victims and alcohol can be super dangerous. We do not need anything that is going to add or make our existence any more difficult. We have enough trouble as is being attacked by race soldiers. Let's try to do everything we can to stay sober so that we can use our brain computer to the best of our ability to solve problems and come up with solutions, new concepts to replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Dr. Francis Kress Welsing, Mr. Fuller, Dr. Kamau Kamban, a lot of the folks that we esteem, they would strongly endorse sobriety to help us get this problem solved ASAP. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.